Academy Award-winning filmmaker Danny Boyle, star and creator of HBO's Crashing Pete Holmes, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Clam. And now, here's your host, a man who just discovered a slew of new cable channels, Justin Kaufman.
Nothing worse, right? To have a certain package, you think you know all the channels? Flipping through last night? Oh, MLB, I never get that. Click on it, it works. I know, right? Just an idiot. All the way around. Idiot! So frustrating. I mean, I could have been watching the World Baseball Classic this entire time. Although it's probably one of those great sort of, you know, features that you get for a month and then you have to pay for it once you really get in. And again, when am I going to watch MLB Network? I'm really not. It doesn't really matter. So maybe I shouldn't beat up on myself so much.
I don't know. I find when you have it, you find you'll end up watching it. You'll watch the stupidest things. You'll watch grown men in suits on fake baseball fields trying to do plays. You will. You will.
You will. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is the number. I tell you that number because I want to hear from you, of course. Tonight, the swap meet, 10 o'clock. Greg Flam's going to be with us. My favorite segment all week long. This is where we collectively, we brag about each other's junk. I know that sounds terrible, but it's true. Collectibles, valuables, memorabilia, junk. It's a great, I love it. And I'm getting to know all the listeners, and people call in and send pictures to us of weird lamps that they've collected and signatures that are fading away from a foul ball they caught in the 80s. Maybe someone will have some Dallas Green stuff. I don't know. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock tonight. Coming up at the big table, I'm very excited about this, Academy Award-winning filmmaker Danny Boyle. He is a director of T2, Trainspotting, which is in theaters on Friday. Awesome to talk with him. How great is that? Slumdog Millionaire, 127 hours. Steve Jobs, that's just, he's done a million film. Every film he does is one. When I went through his IMDb, I was just like, oh, I love that film. I'd watch that. I mean, even The Beach, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, The Beach, Danny Boyle. We'll talk with him about what it means to go back. To go back home, to go back to the story, to go back to Trainspotting, as these characters in this movie. Really, it's an amazing feat. Ewan McGregor is 21 years older in this film. They don't have to wear funny mustaches or change their hair or do anything, use CGI, right? They just, no green screen needed. So we'll talk with Danny Boyle coming up at the big table. Tonight, the Chicago International Television Festival is in town, and that means they'll be putting on some great screenings of some people from Hollywood, New York City, including former Chicago stand-up comedian Pete Holmes. He is the star and creator of Crashing on HBO. Great show, halfway through the first season, just renewed for season two. It is executive produced by Judd Apatow. I love it. I think it's one of the best new shows on television. I'm saying it right here that he'll definitely be in the mix when it comes to Emmys and awards next year for the work that he's doing on this program. And, you know, a kid who spent a lot of time in Chicago going to open mics and trying to be a stand-up comedian, finding his way in Hollywood with the show HBO's Crashing. We'll talk with him coming up at the 9 o'clock hour. And Jonathan Pitts will be here. This is his 20th year as executive producer of the Chicago Improv Festival. Great festival. It's been around, obviously, 20 years. But this is his last. He retires after this year, hands it off to others. We'll talk with Jonathan about his time with the Chicago Improv Festival and his reflections on the community coming up in the 9 o'clock hour as well. And Mike Fouché, of course, here on Wednesday night, talk about all things politics. I want to talk about Susana Mendoza. She's sort of becoming the spokesperson for the Democratic Party in sort of the fight, almost like a proxy fight with Governor Rauner. So we'll talk with him about Susana Mendoza. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. Let's download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's get this show on the road. We got a huge one tonight, so why don't we kick it off with the carryout? It's, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news to you at home. You don't have to. All right, here are today's top stories. The House Committee Chair, Republican Devin Nunes, quoted an anonymous source in saying that some Trump communications were incidentally intercepted during the campaign. Sounds a lot like a third down pass from Jay Cutler. This could be what President Trump was referring to when he called Obama a bad and sick man for wiretapping. But the House committee wasn't too happy with the chairman's rogue press conference and briefing at the White House. Turns out he did it all without telling the committee. Raising fair questions. Are you in charge of investigating the White House, or are you a surrogate for the White House? It's like if I were investigating you for listening to too much AM radio, and then your buddy told me that you were indeed listening to too much AM radio. And then I, instead of confirming the information, went on the air and told you you're listening to too much AM radio. Wait, can I start that over? I feel like I messed that up. You know, imagine you order a pizza. No, it's just not good with metaphors. Anyway, you're good. Keep listening. I should have done it with pizza. Tomorrow's big on Capitol Hill. The House is set to vote on the replacement bill for Obamacare. President Trump says that all Republicans must vote for this bill, Trump Care, even though some don't plan on it. He says if it fails, they'll likely lose their seat in 2018. See, Trump wants this to pass not only for the optics, of course, but for the most important part, the part that frees rich people from paying for health care subsidies. Once that's gone, he'll be able to change the tax code so that rich people will never have to pay for anything ever again. I think that's the exact language of the bill. Will be an interesting day tomorrow and the first big legislative challenge for Donald Trump. Just imagine the flurry of all cap tweets if it doesn't pass. I think I'll stay off social media tomorrow. But President Trump would be happy to know that the state of Illinois has shot down the idea of giving former President Barack Obama his own state holiday. And you know what? I, for one, I'm glad that didn't happen. Sorry, but why would Obama get a holiday named after him? Because he lived here? So did the guy who invented Garrett's popcorn, and I don't take off work for a random April for it, right? I mean, sorry, but if Texas doesn't give a George W. Bush Day, and Arkansas doesn't give a Clinton Day, and there's no, is there a Reagan Day? I'm not sure. I'm keep going. Nixon Day, Ford Day, Carter Day. I don't think there's a day for any presidents. Then there's a day. It's called President's Day. No go on an Obama holiday. That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe after he dies, we can revisit. But right now, no Obama holiday. AT&T is mad at the state of Illinois because it wants to stop providing landline service to customers. Yep, the state mandates that they provide the landline options, although many consumers don't use them anymore. Some don't even know what it means. Landline, what's that? Is that a Google feature? What does that mean? That pops up when I'm looking for Uber? What's this, a phone in front of me? What do I do with it? Do I push the buttons? What do you mean rotate? What's the word rotary? You mean swipe? Where do I swipe? Sears is in trouble. Some insiders have said that there are serious doubts about the future of the company, which, to be fair, seems to be the current state of all retail. But in this case, will it be for real? Sears, which always seems to be on its last leg, is it really on its last leg now? No, it can't be. Where will we go to steal air conditioning on a hot day? Or walk through the building on a cold day? You can't do that to us. Oh, you just changed it to Kohl's? Cool. That's cool. The Lollapalooza lineup was announced today, and Chance the Rapper is the headliner for the festival, which is crazy to think that Chance started out on a side stage. Also crazy because it's, what's Lollapalooza without the Red Hot Chili Peppers? Sorry, I didn't see them on the lineup, so I don't know what to do. What do me and my 45-year-old friends do? The festival will take place August 3rd through 6th, which would be a good time to avoid the Metra. Lots of angst and jean shorts. Going to be on that weekend Metra. In weather, I didn't even realize it was spring. Yep, I guess that happened on Monday. Huh. It's 31 right now, supposed to get to 71 on Friday. 40-degree swing. In sports, Jerry Krause died yesterday at the age of 77. Today, Dallas Green at the age of 80. Arguably two of the biggest general managers in Chicago sports history die a day apart. Green was the GM for the Cubs in 1984, brought in Jim Frey, Larry Boa, Ron Say, Ryan Sandberg, Sutcliffe, Thad Bosley. I think Thad Bosley was a Dallas Green guy. I don't know. Seems like Dallas Green was a GM before GMs were widely hated. Everyone loved Dallas Green, right? Greatest Cub team ever. Well, second greatest, but And then there's Jerry Krause, where he was really the poster child for the new GMs. Unliked, even though he brought Chicago 6 championships. He drafted Scottie Pippen, Horace Grant, reached for a European player named Tony Kukoc, even took a flyer on a player like Dennis Rodman. But Krause will also be remembered as a guy who sparred with the big egos on a team that ultimately lost its best players in Chicago. Let him walk. Ugh. Remember that? Late 90s? Ugh. Then he made that trade, Elton Brand trade, and he brought in those Twin Towers. When you could still call them the Twin Towers. Remember that? The Hawks finally lost last night, although not after they came from behind to force an overtime. An overtime loss. No big deal. That's good in hockey, right? Team has 9 games left, up 6 points. Those numbers tell me that the Hawks are going to hold on to the number one seed. But then again, hockey uses that common core math. So, I don't know, a 6 times 2 plus 4 divided by Thursday, and the Hawks are out of the playoffs. I don't know. I don't know what just happened. The Bulls lost to the Raptors last night, which is kind of a shocker. And they're facing off against the Pistons tonight, who currently have a 2-game lead on the Bulls for the 8th spot. Again, that's what Bulls basketball has become. Hardcore determination for that 8th spot. We're coming hot after that 8th spot. Ugh. All right. The World Baseball Classic is tonight, the U.S. versus Puerto Rico. So one more meaningless game for Javi Baez. The White Sox are giving shortstop Tim Anderson the biggest contract ever awarded to a position player with less than 1 year playing time. It's such a specific stat. 6-year, $25 million deal, which if he turns into an all-star is great. And if he turns into the next Alexei Ramirez, it's probably still great. I don't know. It seems like not a lot of money for an athlete. And finally tonight, 2 Illinois lawmakers introduced bills today to legalize marijuana. It's a long shot to legalize weed in a state that doesn't even like medical marijuana. And with a new attorney general who wants to put the kibosh on the legalization movement, this doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. Both bills want to make marijuana recreational in limited amounts, which sounds like a great tagline for life. Recreational with limited amounts. I'll take it. Well, that's the carryout for March 22, 2017. Speaking of limited amounts, we're almost out of ketchup. Don't cry about it. You know you got some at home. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché's in studio. We'll go over all the political movement this week. There's been a lot going on. Talk about police reform, the FOP contract, or not the contract, but the election. Talk about Susana Mendoza and emails and Rahm Emanuel. That's coming up here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martillo, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm good.
Good.
I had a good, strong fantasy baseball draft tonight. I love playing.
Are we back around
we're
to that
back,
again?
We're back. All right. It's time to play.
All right.
And it's really, you know, as a 3-time champ, I don't like to brag, but I was champion last year. That means I pick last.
Okay.
Right? It's a 12-team league. And because there are so, I play with so many great people from Chicago.
Sure.
The homer quotient is high. All the Cubs go in the first round.
Hmm.
And they don't necessarily need to go in the first round. So I was the 12th pick. You know, I got Bryce Harper.
Really?
Yeah, right?
It's not
he's
a bad
usually
pick.
Like the top 5 guy, but because Lester, Arrieta, Rizzo, Bryan, everybody else went.
So you can't be doing that, though. I mean, I know you love your Cubbies, but you never know what, I mean, from year to year.
You can't, yeah, just
Harper's
don't let them
pretty,
know.
You know, I mean, he's
don't
pretty
let them
consistent.
Know.
No. I like him on the Nationals. I mean, he's a good player.
He is. He's yeah. a good. I definitely didn't expect it at 12. Anyway, so, you know, when I write the book about it, you'll... About my
as
draft.
As long as I get an advanced copy signed.
Yeah, right. I don't like it.
Oh, well, it's different. It's
I
different
like
music.
The grime, the grit.
Yeah, I like the grit too. Actually, I was listening to some like Sister Sledge beats.
Yeah. I mean, as one does.
Well, you know me. I'm always mixing it. I got my 12
sure.
inches back home.
Sure.
Me and Frankie Knuckles.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Mike Fouché in for his Wednesday check-in. Of course, Mike is the guy behind the Daily Line, Chicago, dailyline.net. He comes on every Wednesday to talk Chicago and Illinois politics. And why don't we start with Illinois politics? This week, very interesting to me, the City Club had a speech, and it was Susana Mendoza, the comptroller. And
right.
She has come out of the gate, and you've known her for a long time, so it's not surprising to you, but to us. She's funny, and she's also taking on the mantle of I'm the one who's going to take on Governor Rauner. Why?
You know, one thing about Susana Mendoza is that she's always been somewhat of a charmer. You know, from her earliest days in the legislature, that's been her signature. She loves to smile and joke, and you know, so she's easy to get along with if she's not against you, right? And I think that her thing has, but the other part is that she's never really been known for being a big policy wonk. So let's just put that right out there. There aren't any big signature pieces of legislation that Susana Mendoza passed, and it's hard to find a city clerk who's known for any real legislation, although she did good administrative stuff, and she didn't go to jail, which is saying a lot for a lot of Chicago
put
clerks.
Put that right at the top of the resume.
Right, she didn't go to jail, and she didn't do anything really bad. But so now that she's the comptroller, I think that she's really kind of falling into her MO, which is she is a very partisan person. She's very much a Democrat, big D Democrat, bigger D than everybody else. And, you know, I think that she has in her mind, Bruce Rauner is a terrible guy and he's bad for Illinois. And what I need to do is do everything I can to put a stop to him.
Puts him on the defensive. We saw with Governor Rauner this week having to explain expenditures, things that he hasn't really had to do. The question I have is that's usually a role, the sort of pointing out the governor's foibles, that's reserved to leadership roles like Mike Madigan, of course, or the Senate president or the mayor of Chicago. But it is interesting, a fresh face, a new voice. And in a way, we've kind of grown old of the mayor and the speaker and the others.
The problem that Emanuel and Madigan have is that they've pretty much been negated by Rauner. I mean, you know, Madigan is essentially a curse word south of I-80. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel, well, he's from Chicago. So everything from Chicago is bad in the rest of Illinois and a lot of Illinois in the mines, Illini, I don't know what we are.
Illinoisans.
Illinoisans. And so, you know, they really don't have much credibility anymore. And Mendoza, like you said, is a fresh face. And as comptroller, she actually has a lot of power. You know, she has the ability to choose when things get paid when. And if there's not enough money, then she has a lot of power. She has the ability, if there was plenty of money and everything could be funded all the time, well, you know, great. You know, here, you get paid. But now she decides who gets paid. And that can really throw a wrench into the works.
And you know, she's really making a point about that Governor Rauner hasn't accomplished anything. She has really taken him to task on discretionary spending and So, I mean, there is something to be said about this was a race that, when it comes to comptroller, Governor Rauner wishes he won because it seems like the thorn in the side is at least taking away from the big picture items and the budget stuff that needs to be done.
Well, so the question mark is, is Susana Mendoza really just winding up to run for governor herself? Mm. You know, she's a very visible Democrat. She is taking a lot of slugs at him, and she really gets a free pass at hitting at him. And he doesn't have a whole lot that he can say back other than, well, you're a
Would you think for
person.
The next, for the upcoming election?
No, 2018.
You would, really?
There's,
that'd be kind
there's
of
a lot
quick
of talk
jump,
about,
right?
You know,
interesting.
It could happen. It would be an easy slide. She's already raising money. She credibly can raise money as comptroller. She could have a nice, decent, you know, sack of money in order to get going. All she has to do is just pass the petitions around starting in August, and, you know, boom, she runs.
Well, this week the news was Daniel Biss, the state senator from the
Evanston-Escoki,
mm-hmm. Got in the race as well, kind of taking on the rich people should pay their fair share party.
He, you know, he's a former University of Chicago mathematician. He is a serious wonk. He's a nice guy, but he's a serious wonk, and his politics are pretty left. You know, he is in a lot of the same space as Amaya Pouar.
Well, you mentioned on this show before that, you know, the idea of someone running a Bernie Sanders-like campaign at the state level is a lot harder because name recognition and those commercials and all that kind of stuff, that's effective on the state level, not as effective on the national level. Trump can get away without having commercials because of that, right?
Right. Well, and the big difference between Daniel Biss and a lot of other people is that, now you may remember he was in a primary to run against Susana Mendoza for comptroller, and he dropped out. But he dropped out not after, not until he had actually raised a little over $1 million.
Interesting.
And so he ended the campaign with this huge sack of cash. And, you know, pretty much everyone expected, okay, now he's going to run for governor. That's what it's really all about. And so he starts with $1 million. And he's from Evanston and Skokie, and he has a lot of relationships in Wilmette, too. I think, actually, he represents Wilmette, too. And, you know, there's plenty of money up there. That's a good place to raise money.
Mike Fouché in studio. He's the man behind the Daily Line. You can find it at thedailyline.net. We still want to talk about Rahm Emanuel's emails and also police reform. I mean, there's a lot of police reform happening this week.
I'm wondering if there's going to be but the emails cry for Rahm Emanuel as well.
I want to know what the email. I'm just fascinated. Is it a Gmail?
Have you read
AOL? Them? No, I haven't read them.
They're all out there. I'll send them to you. You know, we can read them.
I don't really want to read it.
He had
I
a
feel
server.
Dirty. I don't want to read it.
He had a server, rahmemanuel.com.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Of course he did.
Yeah,
of
I know. Isn't that great?
Mike Fouché, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. You like that?
That's a jam. I bet Frankie Knuckles would love
if
that.
If you've been paying attention at all to Mike Fouché's segments, he's been complaining about the intro music for the last 3 months. I've loved it.
It's because basically I am the arbiter of taste. I just want to get that right out
there. The gritty Hill Street Blues type music was perfect.
The great thing
now
about...
Now you've lightened it up. You've fluffed it up.
The great thing about your audience is that they have no idea how much taste I truly have.
They really don't.
They don't.
Mike Fouché in studio as he is every Wednesday here on the show from dailyline.net. All right. So let's talk Chicago politics. The big story, the Tribune got... finally got to a judge released emails that were personal emails of Mayor Emanuel. And once again, politicians doing city business in their personal email.
Government business. Yeah.
Government business. Yeah. And what was pulled out, which is very interesting, was how many people were emailing that personal email for interest, for
corporate leaders.
For lobbying,
yeah,
essentially.
Lobbying,
and that's
yeah.
against the law.
Well, it's not against the law to contact them. And the law says that you have to register as a lobbyist. And then once you register as a lobbyist, you're supposed to be reporting your contacts with city officials or legislators every time that you actually attempt to lobby for something. And so what's kind of amazing is there was this huge dump of email that was put out last year. And we all went through them, all us reporters, and looking at all the stuff. And, ooh, you know, we got all our stories out of it. And then the folks down at the Board of Ethics, it's kind of amazing. They said, oh, look, here's people that are lobbying for things. And they started going through it and tabulating who's lobbying for stuff. And that was, I think, probably the most interesting thing the Board of Elections has done in a long time.
I'm surprised that they did that.
You know,
because there weren't really a push to do that. They kind of did it on their own.
The Board of Ethics has been really, in a lot of ways, a quiet kind of sidetrack organization. And the new chair, William Conlin, who used to be on the police board and is a very well-respected corporate attorney, has really, really turned that thing around. He's really started to apply stuff. And so now what he's threatening is that he's going to, because of all these cases where people were making lobbying contacts and not reporting them, he's threatening to fine them.
Mike, in your estimation as someone who's covered
the
politics,
fines are big.
Do you feel like there's a reason to fine? Do you feel like there's a smoking gun? Do you feel like there's something that's being done nefarious or wrong in this situation? Or is this really just Rahm Emanuel using the wrong email?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. I once was a city lobbyist. I lobbied the city years ago, and I was registered, and I did make contact reports. But the truth is that it's a real gray zone about what exactly is a contact where you're lobbying somebody or not. You know, if I show up at their office and I have an appointment and I say, I would like you to do this, that's very clearly, okay, that's contact.
Right.
If there's another time where you send them a Christmas card and you say, hey, you're really terrific, Mike Fouché, Big Co., you know, is that lobbying? If I run into somebody at a baseball game and we happen to talk about something, is that lobbying? Or more likely a fundraiser, is that lobbying?
Right.
If I send them an email and say, hey, I want to get together with you and I'd want to have a meeting in the next month, is that lobbying? or is the meeting itself lobbying?
Interesting.
It's a big question mark.
Yeah, it is a question. I mean, and it's automatically, because you're talking about somehow in the last year or two, we've, you know, sort of politicized emails.
Right.
You automatically think something is going wrong or something's trying to be hidden. But it isn't necessarily the case, because there really is a gray zone when it comes to this.
I think the application of this is really hard. Now, the Board of Ethics will tell you any time that you have any kind of contact is when you should be reporting it. Boy, you know, then for some of these people, that would mean that you would be carrying around a tablet and you'd be knocking off, you know, all kinds of things. Maybe you would have 6 or 7, 10, 12, 30 contacts in a day. I mean, that, boy, I don't know if that's reasonable.
Mike, let's talk about something. We seem to be talking about this a lot. Obviously, police reform is an issue here in Chicago, and it's going to continue to be. A new community police relations report. What does that mean?
Well, the city has a group that they put together that's going to be working on community alternative policing strategies, where they announced it a couple weeks ago, which is basically improving on the CAP system. And then at the same time, there's another group which is about 11 or so community organizations that started last October to convene meetings with people around the city and ask them, if we were going to have better community oversight of police, what would it be? And they say that they interviewed somewhere around 1,600 people around the city, and they had 19 meetings. And they came up with, it's funny, a lot of the same stuff that was in the DOJ report and the Police Accountability Task Force report. But what they say is, well, we didn't have any experts in the room. These were all people that are from the community, that are neighbors. They're the experts. They know enough. And, you know, so now they're basically saying, okay, our next step is that we're going to take all these things and we're going to make some recommendations about exactly how we should have community oversight. Will the mayor be accepting that? I don't know. You know, he said he has postponed introducing his own version of community oversight until this group puts their idea forward, which, if you read their comments, it seems like it's going to be that they want to have something that is clearly not appointed by the mayor.
Well, this is obviously,
and has no mayor control whatsoever.
This is something that has been back, you know, has been a big part of the police reform movement the last year and a half, community input.
Right.
And there's a lot of times the community feels like they step forward and they say, this is what we want. And they say, no, all right, we're going to put this over here.
Yeah, right.
And then here's what we're going to do.
And I think the Mayor Emanuel has really poisoned the well for himself in a lot of ways with this. And the question is, how do you create an organization that's going to be independent, that's not going to be controlled by, you know, some outside forces? You know, great, you're going to have a whole bunch of elected people. Well, you know, you have a whole bunch of these little elected offices. It wouldn't be hard for maybe the police union to put together their own candidates. It wouldn't be hard for, you know, Mike Rich Guy in order to put up my own candidates. And you could influence a board like that pretty easily. And you know, there's some good case studies like that. In Chicago, the Water Reclamation Board, you know, who knows who's on that board? Well, the people who get contracts from the Water Reclamation Board know exactly who's there.
As we talked about as we wrap up tonight, the last week we talked a little bit about the election for FOP. It sort of went to a runoff. There was a lot of forces that were
right.
But that it continues to be messy. Talk about that race.
Well, so before the president went to a runoff, the current guy, Dean Angelo, actually won in a runoff himself. The term is every 3 years. And the other guy that is now in the runoff is a guy named Kevin Graham, who's a police officer. This is the Fraternal Order of Police, which is just the beat level cops. And Kevin Graham is basically saying that Dean Angelo is not hard enough on the police department. He's not really defending police officers enough. And Kevin Graham also has a residency problem. The Chicago Sun-Times had a story this last week showing that his wife is living outside the city while Kevin Graham declares his residencies at his sister's condo in Lakeview.
Little Jackie Robinson West scandal.
Yeah, he said, I'm a Catholic. I'm not going to talk about my relationship with my wife. So, you know, hey, maybe he's got you know, an Irish divorce. Who knows?
Well, we have to keep tabs on that. We'll wrap up now to get to the news. But next week, let's talk more about that, because that's a fascinating, the ideology as well behind the candidates who are running for that position.
Right.
And how that's going to affect the contract is very, very interesting. Mike Fouché, The Daily Line, joins us every Wednesday. Mike, great to see you.
Good to be here.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is one of the best film directors working today, and he's got the Oscars, the Golden Globes, and the BAFTAs to prove it. Danny Boyle is in Chicago to promote the new film T2 Trainspotting, the highly anticipated sequel to the groundbreaking original, starring Ewan McGregor and Robert Carlyle, among others, based on the books by Irvin Welsh, who was just in here just last month. It's hard to believe that it's been over 20 years since Trainspotting was released, and the sequel picks back up 20-plus years later as the characters of Renton, Sick Boy, Franco, and Spud are reunited, and the film does not disappoint. It's my pleasure to welcome award-winning director Danny Boyle to the big table tonight. Mr. Boyle, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Justin. Very nice to be here.
This is, I mean, technically it's a sequel. But let's talk about these reuniting these characters, because, you know, there's something about the idea that, yes, it's a sequel, but it is a new movie because you're dealing with characters that have grown over 20 years' time.
Yeah, they're so different. It's not like a traditional sequel where you kind of rehash everything, the ingredients, you know, you have a new plot, a bit of a new caper. And indeed, we tried that at one point, and it was terrible. You thought, if we're going to go back to these guys, given the impact of the first film, you're going to have something new to say about them, some progression, you know, something that's both just literally, materially different in front of you. And of course, it's age.
Yeah.
Because it is 20 years plus, really, in the typical hapless fashion of the characters. We missed the 20th anniversary by about 3 months.
That's true.
But there you go. They would be kind of proud of that. They would say, there you go. And it's the I guess what it is, it sort of was weird doing it, because it focused the first film. It made you realize what the first film was about, because there was quite a lot of controversy at the time that was saying, is it about drugs?
Yeah, it's about heroin, or
is it about friendship?
Right.
But actually, what it's about, you realize when you look back at it and you make another one later, is it was about boyhood, really, and the kind of men's love, boys, youths, love, males, youth, love of that energy and carelessness and recklessness of your early 20s, and you kind of take appalling risks with yourself and your friends, and some don't make it. But even the ones that don't make it, you kind of tip your hat, but you move on. You don't really dwell on it, not really.
Yeah.
You just kind of career onwards. And then, oh, that's what it looked like now when we look back at that film, because now it's what that's like when you get to 46, and can you still do the same? And men typically try to relive constantly the past, won't grow up or won't move forward like women accuse us of the whole time. And women deal with age so much better than we deal with it, you know? So it's kind of in that territory where the film's about.
It's fascinating to me, because it really is. I mean, I can't think of any art like this or film where the actual actors are the same, the 20 years later. I mean, everything about it is capturing and really exploring the idea that these characters had to grow. And they had ups and they had downs, and they lived, they take those with. So it's the same actors. It's Ewan McGregor again. Yeah. But he's got that feeling. You got the feeling that Renton has lived 20 years of life. And that adds to, it's a different character.
Yes, he's got a very, very big crisis as well, which happens in literally the first shot of the film you see, which triggers this return of his from Amsterdam to Edinburgh, where he had abandoned his mates and stole their money.
Yeah, that's how the first movie ends, right?
Yeah, that's at the end. He literally walked out on them, and now he walks back in on them, really, with a mystery, really, about what has happened to him and why he is and why he has come back. And he's come back for, well, you have to see the film, but he's come back for highly critical reasons, really, acute reasons of crisis, really, for himself. And he finds his mates almost in a state of status. Begbie's been in prison for 20 years. Spud's been on and off drugs, really in the same state, somehow has survived. And Sick Boy continues to scam in ever-decreasing circles, you know?
I mean, it's fascinating, and it's a tremendous accomplishment to be able to get the actors back together, to get back together with you. You know, talk about those characters. What drew you? I mean, you talked a lot about, you know, why you did the film in the first place, why you based it on Irvin's work. But what drew you to doing it again, and what drew you to the new characters 20 years plus?
I think it was that people kept talking about them. And like you do films, and if you're lucky, some of them are successful. And anyway, whether you're lucky or not, some of them are unsuccessful. But they all fade away over time, right. Gently. They kind of just like have a half-life that just diminishes gently into the background. But this one didn't. It sort of stayed there.
Why do you think that is?
Well, people would talk to you about the characters, and they remembered their names. And nobody remembers characters' names from movies. You remember the actor, maybe, but you never remember what their character name was. And people would come up to me on the tube in London and have this conversation with me about Renton and Spud. And I'd be like, and I couldn't remember a lot of the details of the film, and they could, you know, and they were like, so there was this quality about it that it was still felt alive. And then Irvin, bless him, published a kind of 10 years later sequel book called Porno. And so we felt obliged, really, to have a go at adapting it, and we did, and it wasn't very good. And we learnt something from that, because I think it was okay, but it was a rehash, and it was just the same territory again. And so it was really just a different caper, really. And we decided not to do it, and we didn't even send it to the actors. And then when the 20-year anniversary came about, we met. And I think when we started the meeting, we met for a week in Edinburgh. I didn't think we were going to... I think we thought, this will be it. We just won't be able to do it. We'll walk away. Mm-hmm. And something came out a bit more personal about age, particularly from John Hodge, the screenwriter, mm-hmm. and myself, and that formed it, really, that actually took it into a place where... Well, it's what you see in the cinema, yeah. really, which is this... this transition, which is male behavior over extended time, really.
And the idea, and in a way, I mean, that you can't go back home. You can't try to go back to being 22 years old. And it seems like all the characters in the film, they almost all of them want to go back. They want to go back to a different life, and it's always fleeting.
It's classic. They behave as though they can. Yeah, they yeah. try to. And that gives us, that's very advantageous to us as filmmakers, because it lets us have a bit of the same of the old movie, because they try to recreate it literally. And there's a great scene in the Loyalist Club
yeah.
where they sing this No More Catholic song,
right.
which is a bit of a riot, very offensive to everybody, typical bit like the first film. So you get the flavour of the same kind of thing as they try right. to recreate the effortless bravado of the past. But there's also the new material, which is focused around children, actually. There are some children in the film who belong, that they fathered since we saw them, and for whom they are very disappointing fathers. And there's a couple of imaginary children as well, which is also extraordinary in a way.
Like, yeah.
you think, what's going on there? So a lot of it is that as they begin to... And they do move. They imagine that... Well, they try to recreate the opportunity and betrayal of the first film,
right,
literally.
Right.
There's some more money on offer, and they don't seem to learn.
They don't learn anything.
They're just trying to
right.
work out how to cheat each other out of it. And actually, they get cheated out of it by somebody entirely different, and justice is served, really. And they're left with nothing apart from the opportunity to begin to atone for where they are and what they've done. And there is a movement. It is very poignant, actually. It's surprisingly emotional as they move yeah. towards some kind of acknowledgement of where they are.
Award-winning film director Danny Boyle in studio. T2 Trainspotting is in theaters March 24th. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with Danny Boyle here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Danny Boyle, the award-winning director, film director, of course. So many great credits to your name, including the new movie T2 Trainspotting, the Trainspotting sequel, 20-plus years later, if you call it that, but out in theaters this weekend. I got to say, I am one of the great things about the characters is that they don't follow this sort of Hollywood arc. They're not anti-heroes that turn to heroes. They're not, we do heroin and now we learned our lesson. There's something about it that the despicable part of nature that is within, I would say, all of us, but within these characters, it's unapologetic.
Yeah.
What draws you to that? What about that? Because you've been able to do that with a lot of your work, is to bring characters out that aren't necessarily the prototype or the stereotype of a certain situation.
In this case, it was to do with Irvin's first book, Trainspotting, which I think when we all read it back in 1995, it felt like you'd found Ulysses or a modern Ulysses. It was extraordinary because he, front and centre, unapologetically, as you say, characters who are normally on the margins, who are viewed as victims or idiots or evil.
Or the villains, right.
Yeah. And they're viewed like that. And he put them front and centre, said, no, not only do they have a point of view... and the point of view is acutely about drugs. Mm-hmm. And it's complex and difficult to take on board from the traditional moral landscape of condemning drugs. But this is their world. And not only that, they've got a sense of humour that's going to make you really want to know them. And of course, that's what you get with them, the chaos, the sense of humour that makes you like them. Even Begbie, who is the terrible person. You know, you can't possibly terrible. Like Begbie. But in Bobby Carlyle's hands, you're terrified.
He's the favourite.
And you quite like him.
You quite like him.
You know, it's like, and it happens in this movie as well. He's awful, but you think...
He's awful, he's terrible, but he's also the comic relief in the way that he sort of lives his life. But he's a very dangerous character.
We all know somebody like that. Yes. Not to that extreme, obviously, but you know, within your mates, you've got those characters, yeah. You know. So I think that's that. There are archetype, brilliant archetypes that Irving's drawn.
I was watching an interview today earlier to get ready for this, and you talked about it was in reference to you doing Frankenstein, the stage work. But you said in the stage work, it's the actor's job to tell the story. In film, it's the director's job. You're using the actors as vessels, using the characters as vessels. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you're the one telling the stories in the edit.
Yes.
Trainspotting tells a story of these four characters, others in Edinburgh, as you said, on the margins. But it's the style in which it's told. And it's the film, the directing, the way the stuff stopped, the music was used. The style that came out of that in 20 years ago, 1996, was something that was unique and brand new to us. Talk about that. Talk about your style, bringing that to Trainspotting. How you feel that, you know, you even mentioned it in the last segment, it's still, people are still talking about it 20 years from now.
But it emerges out of what's around at the time. And that's two things. One, it's the characters, and you try and get as much of it to emerge from the actors and the characters as possible, because then it feels locked in. It feels part of the DNA of the film. It doesn't feel like a style that's imposed on the actors, which can happen, because they actually give you the style in a way. So it's coming from them. And it's a quid pro quo. You give a bit and you get a bit back. So, and they see what you're doing and they up their game a little bit towards it, towards that style. So you chase that style with them a bit more. So you get it from them. That's the one thing. And the other thing is you get it from the time. And at the time, MTV was beginning to announce itself. And we were beginning to watch more and more pop videos. And I used to love them. And people said, you can't do that in a movie. That's terrible. Movies are classical. And I was like, well, not really. I mean, I love a classical movie, but actually I really, really, really love an MTV pop video as well. And so you kind of made a kind of like a hybrid of that. So it came out at the time as well. I mean, that's gone away a bit now, really, the pop videos. But if you remember at the time, it was a wonderful exploratory time. It was pushing the frontiers of what you can do with music. And then you harness that music to character. And you've got a really wonderful combination.
Was it tough for you as a new filmmaker, it's only your second movie, to push that envelope, to try new things, to do things that the establishment in the UK or even in Hollywood were like, you don't do that in movies?
We'd had a bit of a success with the first film, Shallow Grave. Yeah. And that gives you a bit of freedom if you don't take too much money. And we didn't take a lot of money for Trainspotting because it was a very odd book to adapt. Nobody thought that it would work. Drug movies don't work generally. And especially when they're in thick Scottish accents, you know, that it's not going to travel, you know. And of course, ironically, it did. But we maintained control by not getting greedy. And that allowed us to have a kind of freedom. And then it's the chemistry of those four and five actors. And it was just that money can't buy that. Only luck buys that. You have a great casting director, but even she doesn't know when they come. She knows they're great actors individually,
but how they're going to work together.
But how it'll work when they get together, and also three of them are Scottish, one of them isn't. That doesn't really make sense, and yet they're all playing Scottish. I mean, it was like a bizarre kind of wonderful coincidence that we bumped into each other. You know, and coming back to it 20 years later. That we just picked it up off the floor as though we'd just put it down.
It's amazing. It's amazing that not only do the characters, you know, obviously the chemistry was great in 1996, but to come back 20 years later and to feel that as the audience, that the characters, they really, truly were boyhood friends.
Yeah.
You know, the time has elapsed. It's really wonderful. One of the characters in the film, when the first film and the second film, is Edinburgh. The stylized, the way that Edinburgh played in the first one and these characters were on the margins was tremendous to be able to see that iconic city and see it with these guys, you know, doing their thing inside of it. This movie does the same thing. I mean, you have a great scene where Renton and Spud go up Arthur's seat,
yeah,
and sit at the top, and you're able to see it, and it almost once again brings that contradiction, that juxtaposition, that this is a beautiful city, arts and culture mecca of the UK, and these are the characters that live in it.
Yeah, these are the guys on the margins, which is why Irvin. It was so revolutionary for Irvin to say, hey, you know your Edinburgh Festival, which is meant to be radical? Here's radical from your own back garden. And he exploded these guys and his stories literally injected them into the town, into the town.
Could you do Trainspotting anywhere else? Does it have to be in Edinburgh? Could you have done it in Atlanta, Georgia? Could you have done it in a different UK town?
I suppose you should answer that you could. I wouldn't be able to. Because it feels so wrapped up in the language. He's so proud of the language.
Yeah.
It's so uncompromising, the linguistic challenge of reading the books, which is, once you unlock it, of course, it's delicious. Because it's like you can read French suddenly. It literally is. It's English, but not in the fashion that you know it. But once it unlocks, it's like you can read a foreign language over, without having to put any work in. You know, and I love that about it. You know, it's such a kind of slap in the face for correct English, you know, what's regarded as correct English. And, of course, it came out of the destruction, the demolition of working-class communities. These were the last vestiges of them, and it manifested itself in Edinburgh in a heroin epidemic in the 80s, when heroin was the HIV capital of Europe. And he wrote these stories about it. He didn't write these pitying stories, you know, liberal stories about guilt and worry about victims. He wrote this defiant scream from these people with a sense of humour, and an appalling sense of humour. This, because of course their humour is absolute. They'll laugh about anything,
right?
You know, which is a tradition we continue in the new film as well.
It's great. Filmmaker Danny Boyle in studio. T2 Trainspotting in theaters this weekend. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. Danny Boyle in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table tonight, award-winning film director Danny Boyle, T2 Trainspotting in theaters this weekend, the long-awaited sequel to one of the most iconic films, of my generation. I was 21 years old. When I saw that movie, I was like, you're in a point where you're looking for something else. You're looking for a different alternative. Yeah. You're looking for underground movies, the My Own Private Idahos, if you will. You know, you're looking for other stuff. And to find Trainspotting, and even though it was a story about the guys on the margins of Edinburgh, Scotland, it resonated with this kid from Chicago. What do you think that's about? Why do you think it resonated with so many people in the States, around the world, that didn't know anything about Scottish culture or Edinburgh or anything in the UK?
I think it is that what you just said at the beginning, you emerge out of your boyhood, really, into a kind of early manhood. And you're kind of looking around for something that lets you object to what's been offered, to the customary stuff that's offered you, a conventional career, you know, mapped out for you. Everything will be as planned as your father did it. And you're looking for something different. And we tolerate it, actually, because it's an important element of development, that rejection, that feeling of questioning, really. And here, it's done by these guys who are at their most acute, and it's expressed, of course, most sardonically and ironically by Renton's Choose Life speech,
right,
where he says, all these choices you're offering me.
All these choices.
Yeah, and then, of course, in the new film, there's an update of that, because, of course, you're doing a sequel. Everybody says, there's going to be an update, yeah, of the Choose Life speech. Yeah. So there is an update of it, but it's interesting, because it appears to be, you know, a litany of updates. You know, it's more social media these days rather than washing machines.
It fits.
But it's a confession as well, actually. It's an angry confession from him that his own choices have resulted in disappointment for him, and that he stands now as a man who has lost some people that he loved, most notably his mother, whose funeral he's not gone back for, and Tommy, and we hear about that when they go to the Scottish countryside once again, and that has consequences that you see played out, and that he's not become the person that he wanted to become, really. And it's a part of a process of atonement for him eventually to arrive, because he appears to have nothing, really, as he says. If you see the film, his relationship in Amsterdam has broken down, and he appears to be left with nothing. And he's 46, and he has a very choice use of words to express
right.
what he thinks about being 46.
But that, I mean, that's a lot of us. I mean, I think of my generation. I'm 42 years old, and I feel like at that time, like watching that movie, it meant everything to say, "Oh, this is against the grain. This is what I'm talking. I choose life." And to be 42 and watch this, I'm like, I did choose life, and here I have some of the same things that these guys are going through is the consequence of choosing life. One of the things I was going to ask about was, it is interesting because the one thing about Trainspotting that we loved was the fact that it did take on issues like heroin use. But the way that movies would take on heroin use was almost like a cautionary tale
yeah.
or something, a figure of some sort saying this is bad and see what's going to happen to you, almost a director or just the idea of the film in general. This film didn't do that. This film said, yeah, there's a lot of consequences to doing these drugs. But it's almost the side thing to what these guys were about. And so in a way, I feel like that's also goes to the idea of giving us something different, something that was against the grain when it comes to filmmaking.
Yeah, it didn't try to patronize people
right.
about drugs because you, especially that audience, you're talking about people of 21 watching it, it's not patronizing them about drugs. You know, it's because the drugs are a part of their life. At that age, they're going to be part of your life. And what you need is education to be wise about. If you're going to travel that route, you're going to need to be wise with it, really. And also, you've got to accept that drugs will always be with us. You know, you can't. You imagine politicians, because they want to have a soundbite, think that they can just be tough on them and get rid of them. But they've always been with us. And heroin especially is a drug that marches beside humanity. And we turn to it medically when we need it, and we'll probably all die self-administering it. Or certainly if you're in a terrible car accident, you'll use it for yeah. amazing and powerful pain relief. And then on the streets, people use it for emotional or psychological pain, really. And that's what they use it for. And, of course, the film doesn't shy away, and this one doesn't shy away from the consequences that can be because of that.
Right.
But nor does it say, just because of that, are these people going to solve their problems by just turning away from
right.
it? They're gonna
not everything's solved by being in recovery. Not everything's solved
by
sober. Right.
No.
And for you to come back to this story, to come back to T2 Trainspotting, to come back and do 20 years. There's one thing about, you know, we talked about what drew you to these characters or coming back. But for you personally, to get back together with this set of actors and the producers and the screenwriters and the crew, I'm sure is similar. What's that like for you? Because you've done so much in your career now and you've worked with a lot of different people. This is the first kind of foray back to something that was 20 years ago for you personally.
It was, but because it was 20 years, it wasn't just like we can redo that. It was like, well, how are you going to do that? Because it's going to be the same actors, but it's got to be different. So how are you going to find that balance of the same and different? And also, how can you create something that will stand beside the other movie? And in a way, that's the toughest thing is to... You know, if you do something poor, you'll get slaughtered, and yeah. quite rightly, because the film is very precious to people. They right. feel like they right. own it. It's not really my film anymore. But you want to create a companion piece to it that allows you to kind of... It allows you to get both films to talk to each other, which they sort of do. Because, as I said, making it, you kind of realise what the first one is about in a way I never really did before. And making this one, when I watched it... in editing, I didn't really understand what it was about. I saw all these children running around. I thought, I'd cast all these children, and directed them. But then when I saw them all together, I thought the film's about, yeah, it's about fatherhood, really. And then you get these, Begbie's father makes an appearance as well.
Yeah.
And you have this extraordinary scene of Begbie and his son, when he kind of finds somehow a way of apologising for the way he's been. So it was weird the way you kind of learnt by doing it. It was a kind of, so I suppose one was stepping into, you think it's known because you've done it before, but actually you're stepping into the unknown of how you can actually do it with this 20-year threads connecting the two films and how they'll talk to
Did you flash back to being 20 years younger and say, have you, all the films that you've done, in between. You've done so many films. You've won Oscars and Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours. I mean, you've done so many great films. What from that experience in those 20 years since you've done Trainspotting did you bring back to this project?
I think it's keeping the budget down. It's just a huge... Sounds so simple. It isn't. But it's so fundamental to be able to do what you want to do. And then you've got a big problem about how to make it look like more than $20 million. So we always try and work under $20 million. And then always try and do everything through your characters if you can. No matter how stylish you're being, how flash you're being, all that kind of stuff, do it through the characters. Because you learn over time that no matter what anybody says to you on press junkets, or that 99% of people go to the cinema to see characters who they identify with. And they're either like they want to be a bit like them, or they don't want to be a bit like them. But they want to see them, and we see.
Yeah.
And it's very primordial. You see ourselves up there as 40-foot high figures, doing stupid stuff, being embarrassing, crying, being terrible, evil. And that is a game that we want to see played out, you know? And you do it through the characters, and that's how cinema works. And so you have to cast well, trust your actors, build that faith in them, and they will respond then, and you'll get the best work out of them. And the finest one of them's kind of blow dust off our souls, really, in some way that's not quantifiable, and yet we kind of... we'll always hang on to storytelling as part of our way forward, I guess.
Danny Boyle, the award-winning, Oscar award-winning film director, so many great films. T2 Trainspotting, the sequel to the tremendous film, does not disappoint. I loved it. I loved coming back and being with those characters again. It was a real great moment for me as someone who really, really enjoyed the first film. Danny, thanks so much for taking some time out and being my guest tonight at the big table.
Thanks, Justin. Pleasure.
Great to have Danny Boyle in here, man. Wow. What a presence. I kind of say at the beginning of that, the idea that not only an Oscar winner, but a Golden Globe winner, BAFTA, tons of BAFTAs. But it's awesome, you know? Like, I mean, I think a lot of times guys like Danny Boyle, they come on the circuit to promote their movie because they have to do a bunch of press, mm-hmm. especially for a movie like Trainspotting where it's not necessarily a huge budget. It's not going to be in every theater,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm sure he gets a lot of interviews, but it just I appreciate and I enjoy that he gives us his time to do that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, and we know this, Pete, and not to pull the curtain back on how this business works, but, you know, most of the time they set these things up. They're like, here's 5 minutes.
Right.
He's going to be on the phone. If you go over 5 minutes, we're just going to hang up on you. So when you ever hear those, and those are almost tailor-made for drive time.
Yeah.
Because morning
it's the
only time you have before you have to hit traffic and weather mm-hmm. and commercials, things like that. But it's amazing that, you know, you get a chance that, I mean, we go and we talk to Danny Boyle's people and we're like, listen, this is what we do. We're going to do a longer interview. You down?
Yeah, you don't hear, on Terry Gross or Mark Maron or something, they don't say like, yeah, can you just call in for 5 minutes?
We do plenty of that too.
Yeah,
no
that's
doubt,
true.
But... I'm so excited. I don't think we're there yet, meaning that, you know, it's we again pull back the curtain, but and rarely ever do we talk about who we're trying to book. But coming up next week, I'm so excited. You know I'm excited about this. We've been, there's Blackhawks games. We don't stay home and pretend, I'm just going to work from home. We come in and we work on booking to try and get people that we want on. And I finally got through to Richard Ashcroft's people. Richard Ashcroft is the former singer with Verve, The Verve.
Mm-hmm.
Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah. One of the best songs of all time.
But he's got a solo album, or, you know, a solo career that's amazing. And I was just listening to his stuff even before I knew he was coming to town. And he's coming to House of Blues next week. And I'm like, how do you get him, right? How great would that be to sit down with him? What a career. What they call a mad Richard. Like in London, like when he was in the paparazzi and all this stuff, when mm-hmm. he was the Verve, you know, and he's just kind of like sneaking in to do his show and sneaking out. So we're trying to get him. But I love it because just trying to convince a Richard Ashcroft to come on 720 WGN has been a fun week.
He'll realize once those album sales start ticking up after the interview
right.
where the place to go is.
That'd be fun, though, to get him. I mean, there's so many questions about... Just like the Verve was really in the shadow for a long time of Oasis and those bands, those Britpop bands. And then, I mean, we probably wouldn't have time, you know, when you do them on the phone, because he's on tour. So a lot of times when you hear when we have people on the phone, that's because they're on tour. They're in Milwaukee.
Right.
They're not coming through until their show. There's rarely ever do we get a chance to like actually get them in studio to be able to also promote the show they're doing. You know, a lot of times when you hear them on the phone, musicians, mostly they're in the back of their tour bus.
Right, exactly. Coming in a couple hours before the show, and then they got sound check, and that's it.
Well, I mean, I remember I was talking with one of the guitar players from Cage the Elephant, who are going to be at Lollapalooza. And that's what he said. I was in Nashville, and I asked him about, you come to Chicago all the time. Like, I'm like, isn't it great? He's like, I'll be honest with you. He's kind of like on the southern drawl. He's like, we don't get off the bus. Like, we park the bus in front of, what's that place called? The Aragon? Yeah, the Aragon. He's like, and we don't ever, like, we sleep on that bus. We eat on that bus. We are tunneled into a sound check. And then we have an hour till it's showtime, so we sit on the bus until it's hour.
Yeah.
So he's like, we don't really get a chance to go see Chicago. And so they live like that from city to city, day to day. But anyway, Danny Boyle is similar in that regard because he probably did press in New York. He probably did press in L.A. You know, he's making the rounds and did press in Chicago. So, and I really liked the movie. I got a chance to see it. I really liked it. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, I was charmed by Mr. Boyle.
He's very charming.
Yeah. I really did as someone who came up and enjoy, like, I'm the right demographic for that because we were 21,
Perfect.
22
yep.
years old when that movie came out, and you're just like, oh, this is all about being outside the lines, living outside the lines. And so for 20 years later, it's sort of like, how do you continue to do that, you know, when you're 44 years old or 42 years old? And that's really what that movie's about. So,
yeah, I'm a little upset in that. I probably saw Trainspotting 12 times from 96 to 98.
Right.
And haven't seen it once since.
Right.
And now that this, you know, new movie's coming out, Danny Boyle's coming in, I'm like, I got to click on demand. Trainspotting's got to be on somewhere.
It's not?
No.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Shouldn't that be, like, this movie's coming out. Put that movie out. You put it out for $1.99.
Right. No, no way.
It's really frustrating.
The only thing they'll do is they'll make it buy. If they want to, $15.99 at some point. But you're right. That is frustrating.
Yeah. Don't
push it is. It really is
me.
Great to see. The movie, you could watch the sequel without having to see the original. But if you did get a chance to watch back to back, it's pretty great. Because they do a lot of inside jokes to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we just keep this ball rolling tonight. Coming up from HBO's Crashing, one of my favorite shows, 2017 Sunday night show. Stand-up comedian Pete Holmes is going to be in studio. He is at the Chicago International Television Festival, the complement festival to the film festival. They're doing it this week. They do it over at AMC River East, right around the corner here. But he's got a screen. He's doing a screening. And I love that show. I really do. It's a show about stand-ups, you know, and I know that they're reading a lot about him and getting ready for the interview. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people saying, another show about stand-up comedy? Didn't we get enough with Louis C.K. or Seinfeld? You know, any of the shows in between? I don't know, man. This show is different to me. This is, I really, really like it. I like Pete Holmes, and I think that at first I was kind of like, yeah. You know, and then now into episode 4, I'm like, this is interesting. You know, it's really a story about him and when stand-ups start. It's not about, oh, I'm on stage. I'm like Louis C.K. I can pop in whenever I want. It's about the grind. If you really love it and you want to follow that passion, this show is about having the flyer. And they put on the back of the flyer the comic's name. So when they get to the box office and say, hey, you've got 5 people took your flyer and they came in, so I'll give you 5 minutes on the stage. If you don't get 5 people, you don't go up tonight. Like all of that stuff. Ugh. I think about those days. That's hard. And he's created a show around it. So Pete Holmes coming up. Also, Jonathan Pitts will be here. It's his 20th anniversary of the Chicago Improv Festival. Not only is it a special anniversary, but it's his last. He's stepping down as the executive producer of the Chicago Improv Festival after this weekend or next weekend. The Chicago Improv Festival has been a huge part of Chicago. We'll talk to Jonathan about why he's leaving and have reflections on the improv community moving forward. And Greg Flam's up at 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. Swap meet. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Big hour this hour coming up. Pete Holmes, Greg Flamm coming up at 10 o'clock as well. Swap Meet, excited about that segment. Coming up next week, the 20th anniversary of the Chicago Improv Festival, a festival that brings the art form of improvisation to several stages and brings back some of the best performers in the world working today. It's running from March 27th through April 2nd. This year, the headliners include Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, Dan Harmon, just to name a few. And not only the shows, but a lot of these performers also stick around, teach workshops. You can find out the entire schedule of performances and workshops at chicagoimprovfestival.org. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years for this festival. I had the opportunity to perform it a few times with my group Schadenfreude. But this 20th anniversary show is special for executive producer Jonathan Pitts, not only because it's a huge anniversary, but because it's his last. After this year's festival, Jonathan is stepping down to pursue other creative projects and endeavors, and he is my guest tonight in studio. Jonathan, good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
Why are you leaving?
Because it's time. You know, if you stick around at anything too long, that's when the bitterness comes in. And then at that point, you're just a bitter old man going, I'll get up and do
some
improv.
Are you bitter now? I mean, you feel like you're at the point where you can...
Nope. No, but I was ready to go like 5 years ago. You know, 5 years ago, I felt like I had done my gig. I had made my contribution. I had shouldered my responsibility and made a contribution to the community. And I was going to leave, probably even move, just to go to another city to try that out. And then my mom got really sick, not looking for like tears, but she got really sick. She had a massive stroke. I'm an only child. So I spent the next 2 years overseeing her health care until she passed away. And there was no reason to leave. And then 1 year after that was wrapping up everything in her estate. Then the year after that was rehabbing her house, which is now on sale. And it felt strange to leave after year 19.
You might as well wait to 20, right?
It's like, what's one more year?
Well, I mean, it is, you talk about, you know, shoulder the responsibility or the idea of trying to accomplish something for the community. Is that what you set out to do 20 years ago? Was to sort of have a mark on the improv world here in Chicago?
Well, 20 years ago when I had the idea, because I remember when it hit me like a thunderbolt, I was working in a festival called Magic City, which was run by Maggie Daly. And that's why I met Frances Callier, because she was working on the festival. And I'd heard a lot about this improv festival in Austin, Texas, which is called the Big Stinking Improv Festival.
Yeah, I did that festival.
Right, yeah. And it was weird to me. I was like, wait a minute, why is there no improv festival in Chicago?
Because we got Second City, right. IO, Annoyance, other places
right,
like that.
Right, the birthplace, the mecca of this, you know, the whole history of that. And I would been working on other festivals. I also worked on, the International Theater Festival, which had been done by Jane Solins. And I worked on the Bailiwick Directors Festival, the Around the Coyote Festival, which Schadenfreude had been in that as well. And I was like, why is there not a Chicago Improv Festival? I was like, there should be one. This is a city of festivals. There's festivals for every single thing you can think of in this city.
There is.
You know, and so I was like, there should be one. And then I was like, it also didn't make sense to me that Chicago didn't have one and wasn't the biggest one around because of the history of this place. And so I reached out to Frances. She said she'd been wanting to do it for like 3 years, but nobody would partner up with her. So we partnered up together. She said she could probably put 3 years into it. I said, I'll probably do six or seven. And we started it up, and 20 years later. And really, the goal was to be able to create a festival equal to the scene of improvisation at the time, to really prove that, yes, the best of this is an art form, you know, because there was still that question 20 years ago. There was still that debate between Bernie Solins and Del Close. Is it a writing method? It's its own art form? What is it? You know, that was the question back then. So to be able to put it in a setting where the best of the work is an art.
Well, you struck gold in a way that the performers on stage in the late 90s were everyone from Scott Adsit to Tina Fey.
Right.
To the Upright Citizens Brigade before they moved to New York. I mean,
Seth Meyers.
I mean, there were
Jordan Peele.
There's so many people that are now, I mean, the pop culture mainstream.
Right.
But at that time, I mean, you're right. The idea that all those people were in town having a festival is a no-brainer. I mean, when you look back on it.
Yes.
But putting all those people on stage, it's a tough undertaking.
Yes, it is, because it's like herding cats. And the more pieces in play, the more something can go awry, and the more that telephone game of miscommunication can happen, even with the best intentions. And also dealing with that many artists who want to do their own thing, That also has its own challenges.
And the idea that they will, you know, you have to deal with egos and who's on stage, sure. who's the top billing,
yes,
who's set, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, also dealing with the theaters themselves, because they all have their own branding that they right. want to be appreciated for. And you know, Francis and I decided that the Chicago Improv Festival should be Sweden. You know, that we support everybody and we support all approaches and all styles, rather than it just be a specific mouthpiece of one of the larger theaters.
Well, one of the you could say one of the reasons there wasn't a Chicago Improv Festival is because this town for so long is dominated by some of the theater companies,
yeah.
including Second City,
yep.
where it's a festival in that building. I mean, there's different
sure.
shows, and they like it that way. They're
yep.
very competitive in that way,
yep.
saying, you know, you had IO and you had Second City, and Annoyance on the fringes, and
right.
and then everyone else, you don't belong.
I always said that it was like having three mafia families. And, you know, if any one of them had made that step forward, the other two would have shot it down. So it really needed to
How did you finesse that? How did you make sure that Second City didn't go, you know what, Jonathan, we'll take it from here? Or IO said, we're not going to be on the same night as these guys.
Sure.
How do you deal with the egos of the companies in Chicago?
We had a lot of meetings and a lot of conversations and a lot of talking with them about what they wanted. And it also helped that the first 10 years of the festival, we produced it independently, by the meaning that we rented out the theaters like the Athenaeum Theater and put the stuff in there, as opposed to doing everything in other places. After 10 years, the feedback I got from a lot of theaters is that they felt like we cared more about celebrities than we did the community. So then I made the move and shifted the whole sort of structure of it to go into partnership with the different theaters and have shows in those theaters and sort of split the door with them. And that worked for a while as well, up until the last couple of years, because there's been this veritable explosion of improv theaters. Like,
and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, there's like...
But I mean, as a festival, you just mentioned the idea of all the festivals, a festival town. Why isn't there
sure.
one for improv? But there's a lot of festivals.
Yeah.
And one of the things, the sort of ideology, the philosophy that goes into a festival is that balance of, you know, who's the headliners and who are the celebrities you bring in, and is it a fair, authentic representation of the community that, you know, does the art, the improv?
Yes.
But in your but there has to be a symbiotic relationship, because you could do a festival with a bunch of, and I don't mean this in any disrespect, but no names who do, you know, every theater and it's there and
mm-hmm.
there's no big name. Or you could do a festival where a lot of, you know, we've seen
right.
a lot of cherry picking where festivals have come in and they said, we're only putting these stand-ups on or these improv, everybody else go away.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to find a healthy balance.
What I've always aimed for is 60% of our acts are from Chicago. That's been one of the things. And then it's a matter of trying to keep tabs of where groups are and how they're growing or how they're, you know, not growing, and then speaking to the venues and seeing what shows we can see. And that's also where it's helpful to have an artistic director, because there's so many things to pay attention to. And the shelf life of groups is so much shorter now than it used to be. And they're just a ton of things.
Right.
I also think that, like, one of the challenges with any festival is, who is the festival for? Are you doing that festival for the audience? Are you doing it as like a showcase for industry people to come see it? Are you doing it
for the improvisers?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like, which is a convention. Like, you know, what is, and
now,
I was,
what was your,
that it's for the audience.
For the audience.
Yeah. Because ultimately we have so many shows happening all the time in the city of Chicago. What the city of Chicago needs is audience development. And I was really proud of it a lot in those first 10 years, that groups that performed at CIF would have more people come to see them after CIF. And that's where we were
yeah.
developing audience and creating that relationship. The
I
parties,
can attest to that, yeah.
The parties are for the improvisers.
You're right. Jonathan Pitts, the executive producer of the Chicago Improv Festival. It's on stage from March 27th through April 2nd. You can find out all the information at chicagoimprovfestival.org. Let's take a quick break. We'll come
sure.
back. And we have to talk about where improv has gone
yeah.
in the 20 years you've been doing the festival. Jonathan Pitts here on The Download. Stay with us. Jonathan Pitts in studio tonight. He's the executive producer, right?
Yes.
Right? Executive
yeah.
producer of Chicago Improv Festival. 20th anniversary festival coming up next week, March 27th through April 2nd, chicagoimprovfestival.org. Jonathan, stepping down after this season, 20 years.
Yep.
You've seen a lot of improv in that time. You've been a part of the community here, but you've also been, you know, the primary role that you've had has been this producer of this festival.
Yes.
You've seen... you have to have been able to see the trends change, the people change,
yeah.
the style change. How has improv evolved in the 20 years you've been doing the festival?
Well, part of it just is a sheer numbers, because maybe there might have been 100 groups in the entirety of Chicago 20 years ago. And now you have like 100 groups playing every weekend. And it used to be that, you know, maybe there was like 1,000 people that did improv in the city. And
if that, right.
If that, it might have even been less. And so everybody knew each other. And now you have like 6,000 people studying at Second City, 3,000 people or more studying at I.O. and, you know, a couple thousand studying at Annoyance and all these. There are so many other training centers that have sprung up that are almost like post-grad training centers that have specific focuses. Improv groups seem to only last 2 or 3 years now, most of them. It's like they're much shorter. And a lot of people that are here are only here for a couple of years because either they get into a really good position at I.O. or Second City, or they hit it, quit it,
well,
and move
on out
their way.
Well, it used to be in Chicago, and it's, I mean, I think this is, now it's hyper-focused, but it used to be you'd come to Chicago to do theater, to do improv,
right,
to figure out your voice before you moved on to the coasts.
Yeah.
And that could be at the same time you were living here. Meaning, you know, it wasn't a process of 6 months. It wasn't a tuition-based experience. You lived here for till you were ready, and then you left.
Right.
We have a lot of artists on the show that talk about that.
And a lot of people who leave at about age 28.
Right.
You know.
So now it's changed in the way that it feels like maybe they're coming here until their Second City program is done, and then they're out the door.
Yeah. And I think it's because everybody wants to be famous. You know, my joke is that right now in America, the only thing we make is content and debt. You know, and we sell the debt to China and we spread the content out everywhere we can. And so now everybody wants to have their own webisode, their own podcast, their own show. And if they can't get hooked into something within a given period of time, then they're going to go out to L.A. or they're going to go to New York. But really L.A. because that's where they want to do.
Do improvisers today, and I ask you this, and I mean, I don't know if you're the ultimate authority on what young improvisers are thinking, but do you think that, you know, like I think about my experience and a lot like mine where we would do even the beginning days of some of these theaters, you know, it's where you would have shows in the back of bars or in the back of these grungy theaters and you'd try to get your friends to come out and there'd be 8 people. Yet there was some beauty. We're going to talk to Pete Holmes about it coming up. This beauty in the process and the struggle. Is that still felt? I mean, are improv groups saying, hey, I love this. I love the fact that we're building it from the ground up.
Yeah, there are, you know, underground. I mean, Upstairs Gallery had that going on for about 3 years. Scott Goldstein just had something that was happening over at the Coyote Building that he had going on for some years. There's a underground show called The Bleep Hole that I can't say what the word is, but they perform in garages and basements, and it's invitation only. And there's also an upcoming theater called The Crowd, which is created by a whole group of people that are all young, and they've got like 100 members in it. And several of them came out of the college improv tournament that we produced, but they've created their own thing. And in those places, they are all very excited about what they're doing and how they're doing it in the same way that I used to see back then in other places.
Do you feel, you know, I can only speak for my generation, but the goal was to make a living off of comedy, to get on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
There were not a lot of options.
Right.
Saturday Night Live or possibly maybe the new sketch show that Fox is producing at the
right.
time. But, I mean, there are so many new places for improvisers and sketch comedians to find work.
Which is part of the reason, you know, Second City, of course, has so many more shows with the cruise ships. And there's a lot more shows. And again, also people being able to generate their own material. That's why they're so interested in creating webisodes or trying to get stuff on YouTube and things like that. There's a lot of ways for people to get their content out in the ways that there never was before.
For you personally, 20 years doing this festival,
yeah.
Why did you stay in Chicago? We know why you stayed at the end. You talked about your family. But what was it about setting up shop here in Chicago?
Well, I grew up in Oak Park, and so Chicago is like my hometown. And knowing people here just made it so much easier. This was because this is the birthplace and mecca of this art form, and because I grew up here, and because I lived here, all those three kind of combined together, and it's like as good of a producer as I am, I would not have been able to do what I did with CIF in another city. There was 40 years worth of history. There was a city that loves its own festivals and its own experiences. I mean, Chicago loves to be able to be proud of itself, you know, as opposed to, you know, being worried about New York or LA. We love the things that we love. We love what we create and the artists that we have that create it. And so there is an appreciation between audience and artists that creates a stronger bond than other places where it's just like, entertain me.
For you, the Chicago Improv Festival turns 20. You're leaving after this year. And I'll ask you the same question I asked at the beginning, just about what do you think your mark has been in the 20 years you've been doing the festival? What is it that you leave behind as you move forward?
I hope that the legacy is something that celebrates this art form and the artists that do it, both in Chicago, around the country, and internationally. And that it's created bridges between all three of those communities to create larger communication between artists joyfully celebrating. Because I believe that it's a divine right as a human being to be able to play. And at the essence of improvisation, in fact, at the essence of all creativity, it's play. And, you know, as you get older, you take on all these responsibilities, but it's easy to forget the responsibility you have to still be able to play. And that's part of what keeps you young and alive and connected. And that's what I hope would be the legacy, because we honored the people who came before. We showcased a lot of people. We gave a lot of presents, had a lot of laughs for a lot of people. So I hope that that is like a legacy of play.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you do next. Jonathan Pitts, executive producer of the Chicago Improv Festival, celebrating its 20th anniversary. Jonathan's last. He's the founder, co-founder of the festival. He leaves after next week, March 27th through April 2nd. Scott Adsit, Rachel Dratch, Dan Harmon, Francis Callier's back with Angela Shelton. Lots of shows. You can find them all at chicagoimprovfestival.org. Jonathan, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, the 53rd Chicago International Television Festival is taking place over at the AMC River East 21 in Streeterville. This is the yearly festival that's the complement to the Film Fest that happens in October. This year, there are great screenings and special events, including a screening of the new HBO show Crashing. Crashing is about halfway through the first season, and it was just announced there's going to be a season two. Crashing is a comedy created by and starring stand-up comedian Pete Holmes. It's produced by Judd Apatow. The show follows the character Pete, who's trying to become a professional comedian in New York City. It shows the hardships and day-to-day life of a stand-up trying to make it. But in Pete's case, adds on the personal element of a failed marriage and, well, no money and no place to stay. It's one of 2017's best new television shows, and I'm convinced great things lie ahead for the show that combines great laughs and great heart. In studio with me tonight, the creator, stand-up comedian, and former Chicagoan, Pete Holmes. Pete,
hey,
thanks for being here.
What's happening? What a lovely intro.
No, thank you. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
I'd come for an intro. I'd drive very far to hear an intro that was that fine.
So is it, I mean, is it special to have this screening at River East in Chicago, a place that you did a ton of what you're talking about in Crashing you did here?
I know. The woman that's moderating the panel is a very funny improv named Rachel Mason, who I haven't
we
seen
know Rachel,
her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in years. But when I first came to Chicago to visit to find an apartment, I used to fly to Chicago just to go see Second City and just to go see Improv Olympic, or IO, as it's called now. And then eventually I was coming out looking for an apartment. And Rachel, like, gave me the lay of the land. She took me to Improv Olympic. She made sure that I got called up on stage when they were looking for someone to talk about their weird dreams or whatever to inspire a sketch. And now she's moderating this panel. It's amazing to be back. And I ran into a great local comic, Mike Toomey, when we were doing press this morning. I just keep seeing amazing, hilarious Chicago people. It's
incredible. you spent a good amount of time here. I mean,
3 years, yeah.
Yeah,
three important years. Sorry to interrupt. No. The beginning years.
Well, a lot of this show is about beginnings.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get too much into the plot, but it's beginnings on how you start your stand-up comedy career, but also beginnings and starting anew when it comes to your marriage, things of that nature. Talk about how much you draw from your Chicago experiences makes it into this HBO show.
Well, I think the universal experience of going after your dream, whatever it is. People ask me a lot of times, why is there another show about a stand-up? And I'm like, really, it could be any dream poured onto this person. Stand-ups just always have a great excuse to be funny and interesting, and instead of seeing a therapist like in a great show like The Sopranos, we know what they're thinking because they talk about it on stage.
Right.
So it's a great device. But, you know, the show doesn't take place in Chicago, but a lot of the themes, the struggles and the bombing and just really, it lasts 10 years. Like, you're not good at stand-up. The best stand-ups weren't good for 10 years, most of them. I mean, there's weird ones like Chappelle and stuff that just, like, came out of the womb. with a microphone already killing with the doctors. Right. But like most of us humans have to do it for about 10 years. So I saw that like most shows like, you know, Louis, I love Louis. I love Seinfeld, obviously. These shows feature successful comedians.
Right.
And we were like, what would happen if we showed – my favorite thing about superheroes is the origin. I want to see what it takes and the grind. And we get a lot of – or I get a lot of emails, rather, from Chicago comics, from New York comics. We're all over the country saying, this show accurately shows what it's like.
Well, I mean, everything from, you know, negotiating for stage time, barking on the street corner, mm-hmm. trying to hand out flyers. I mean, that's a big part of this show. It almost feels like a love letter to the process of becoming a stand-up
comedian.
Yeah,
why skip over that? That's the best part. I know there is like some parts of our show that are like funny and uncomfortable funny, but that to me is the most interesting thing. And if I don't make something funny out of it, what was that all about going through it?
Well, I mean, a lot of people think about stand up and they think, okay, well, people get on stage and they perform, and if they do shows where there's three or four people in the audience, or they do shows where they bomb, they should probably just give it up. Maybe
right.
they're not going to be
That's
the next
right.
Chris Rock or Jerry Seinfeld. But like as you said, I mean, there's a process to perfecting the art form that is being a professional stand-up
That's
comedian.
Right. Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld bombed hard for a long time, I'm positive. And then, you know, they figure it out. But to me, especially if you are interested in stand-up or pursuing any sort of kind of creative endeavor, I think it might be comforting to watch a show that is a love letter, is an appreciation of those hard years, because you know how it is. We all look back on those struggles and go yeah. like, those were that's the good stories and the good laughs.
Right.
Nobody wants to, then it just, you know, I liked Entourage, but our show is not Entourage. It's not like me on a private jet with five friends. It's me at a Holiday Inn wondering what happened. I mean, and that more accurately reflects what stand-up feels like.
Stand-up,
and that's a yeah. beautiful thing.
Stand-up comedian Pete Holmes in studio. He's in Chicago tonight as part of the International Television Festival, Chicago International Television Festival, on stage at the screening at the AMC 21. You know, the show Crashing, how much of it is it the character Pete based on your life? I mean, there has to be some, I mean, obviously there's some things that are similar, but how
yeah.
much of it is your upbringing, who you are?
Well, I went to a Christian college, like a proper Christian college, where you could like major in the Bible. You could get like your degree in youth ministry. I always joke that my mom wanted me to be a youth pastor, but when I became a comedian, she said close enough, which I thought was a really nice response. But I grew up in that world, and I grew up where if you were serious about somebody and if you dated them, especially if you had done any sort of physical activities with them, you married them.
Right.
So I married the first girl that I dated, my first girlfriend, my college girlfriend I dated for like a year and a half, and then I was going to move to Chicago. Chicago actually plays into my marriage. And I was like, well, we're not going to move in together. That's called living in sin. I mean, everybody knows you're not supposed to do that. So we got married. A big part of it was like, I was like, I got classes at Improv Olympic on Tuesday. We got to get married on Friday, and then we'll drive out on Saturday, Sunday, Monday. You know, like that was crazy. It was that's how obsessed I was with coming here and being a comedian. Which ultimately I think is why my wife was like, I think he loves comedy more than me.
Well, there's that I mean, there are several ways in which, you know, the series starts and you're already faced with the dilemma of your marriage.
Yeah.
And there are several times where there might be a situation where, you know, you can reconcile, and comedy gets in the way of that. And
yeah.
it continues to be the through line, almost like a mistress, if you will, like
it is.
To the idea of breaking up who you were and pushing you to who you want to be.
That's exactly right. That's well put. I think Pete's having the first affair. I think in the show he fires the first shot. And that's something that you don't really see. But I think what we're trying to do, because it doesn't vilify my wife's character at all for having an affair, it's two people making a strange play at what they really want out of life. But Pete is, you know, stealing out and doing shows at night and more importantly, is really, really obsessed. Like the series opens with Pete making jokes while they're supposed to be having sex. And that's just such a perfect way to show he won't focus up.
Well, there's something about it too, and I've read some pieces that, you know, interviews with you as well, just about the idea of marrying someone who's not in the business.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a lot of comedians will flock to each other.
Yeah.
You know, that's because they understand what it takes, and there's a lot of
yeah.
what you have to do at night. But marrying someone who at some point or another is going to be, I don't want to say fed up with, but okay,
yeah.
this may not be the time for jokes, comedian.
Right, sure. It can, I mean, it takes a special woman or a special man to date a comedian. And sometimes we do, you know, end up with each other, and that can work out well. There's a couple people that Jim Gaffigan's wife is a very funny comedian, for example. But in my experience, Valerie, who I just got engaged to, she's just like aware that we're in a three-way with comedy. Like, you know what I mean? It's polyamorous, and we're both. Luckily, she's into comedy too and enjoys coming to Chicago.
Pete Holmes is my guest. We'll take a quick break here. He is screening his show Crashing tonight at the 53rd Chicago International Television Festival, taking place at the AMC River East. We're talking about the show, the HBO show Crashing, and Pete's career. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More with Pete Holmes on The Download. Stay with us. All right. Good job. Welcome back to The Download here. 720.
I didn't know who you were talking to. You're like, all right, good job. Were you talking to yourself? All right. Nailed it. Let's go.
That's how you, as a radio host, you have to do that, you know?
Buddy, I just did morning TV, and ladies, will you back me up? Every joke I made, I went, that's a great joke.
That's a great joke.
Every joke. And you know what? That actually feeds nicely into Crashing. That's what comedy feels like. Yeah. You're not good yet, but you tell yourself you're good.
And then
even when you are good, like you, you still have to say,
you have to have affirmations. You have to affirm yourself.
That's right.
Yeah, there's something about the show, and a lot of, you know, you mentioned another show about stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
But there's something great about the way you treat your story, because there's a lot of humor. There's a lot of bumbling around. There's a lot of cameos, mm-hmm. really funny people. There's hijinks, things like that.
Yeah.
And that
shenanigans.
You could put a trombone in any of that stuff. You know, you could make it however. But you choose to play it real. You choose to play it in this way that does this combination of laughs and heart. Talk about that. Talk about how important it is for you guys to be real with your story as opposed to sort of highlight the jokes and kind of highlight the bumbleness of the story.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was surprised but also delighted when Judd kind of basically said that comedy is the last thing we do. It's like we try and make it real and honest, and then the jokes are not the easy part, but they're certainly the fun part. So if we write a scene that's authentic and honest, mm-hmm. it, then when we're shooting it, you're with Lauren Lapkus or George Basil or Artie Lang or T.J. Miller, we can probably riff around, I want to say like 80%, 90% of the jokes sometimes were improvised. But the scenes were written very straight. And as long as the emotion was right, we could get it. And then I also think the other thing that sets the show apart, which we didn't necessarily intend on, because we were just telling my story, was that my character is religious. Because he believes in God and because he has a certain ethic to him, a very common ethic in our country, which is one of the reasons why I think people are relating to the show, is he's not somebody that when his wife leaves, he goes and buys some drugs and goes on a sex rampage. You know, he's conflicted. The story has been lifted from beneath his feet, you know, and he's trying to make sense of what he believes and what's been happening.
Well, even beyond the religion, the spiritual side of it, the, if you will, the mindfulness of it, the positivity. The character is so positive in the face of a lot of tragedy.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, being, you have no place to stay, you have no money.
Yeah.
But you're very excited to hand out flyers on the street to get 5 minutes of stage time and stay in a place to give a great line in the last show about doors.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of doors. But there's this concept that you find a way to find positivity out of this life that seems to be spiraling in the wrong direction.
Well, what's happiness? What really makes us happy? It's a strange thing. I guess the show is kind of quietly arguing that it's not money or success or fame. It's finding some way to express yourself and doing what you really feel like you should be doing. So there is something nice. I like watching the show because it reminds me of that time that I try and hold on to in my daily life where it's just about, I just want to tell jokes for these people. Mm-hmm. I just want to take what's inside and bring it out and have people see it and enjoy it if they can. And it had nothing to do with, you know, making it big or whatever.
Well, I mean, for you now as a successful comedian, I mean, you Made It Weird, which is a great podcast.
Thank you.
358 episodes,
something like that.
At the HBO specials, Comedy Central, this show, TBS. I mean, you've done so much. Do you struggle with some of the concepts that are in Crashing, this idea of just wanting
what's happy or just
wanting to perform or content with all these other things that are now surrounding it?
The challenge is to maintain that initial ember of fire inside of you and following your call and what you want to do. And that really is what will make you the most happy. I was actually just thinking that when you showed me where the bathroom was. I went to the bathroom. I was trying to think about, like, I was having such a good day, and it's great to be here in Chicago and showing the thing. And it's just what really it comes down to is this little secret you have with yourself that you're touching that part inside that really needed to be touched, and you're touching it. And it feels really good. So I'm not going to say that I don't enjoy the prestige of things or staying in a nice hotel or eating a nice meal or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the thing that feels best is when you're like, you're in your lane. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're flying behind some other plane and you're in that calm air, and it just feels nice to not be going against your nature and not be going against your intuition.
A big part of the show is the camaraderie with the other comics, whether it be T.J. Miller, who you've known for years, or yeah. Artie Lang, or the comics in the most recent episodes. But there is this camaraderie as much of it is as a solo profession. Yeah. And a lonely profession, and sometimes depressing when you bomb up on stage.
Sure.
There's a camaraderie in stand-up comedy that really shines in Crashing.
Yeah, and TJ actually has a great line about that where he says, you know, when you're starting out, it's when you're surrounded by your friends. And you probably experienced that when you were doing stand-up. You have, even if you bomb, you still have drinks and stuff with mm-hmm. your buddies, and that's what we would do at the Lion's Den. Even if it went badly, you still had each other. And then you make it, and then you're alone. This is why I bring Valerie, my fiancé, my girlfriend, with me everywhere. Because that's one of the reasons why I think Steve Martin, he said in his book, he stopped doing it, was because when you start, it's all fun. And then when you make it, it's just an amphitheater filled with 10,000 people that you won't talk to, and you just do the show. So it's important to, this sounds so old-fashioned, but like, maintain some actual human connection.
Is that hard to do in L.A.? I mean, when you have all of the people that you came up with, the T.J. Millers or all the people from Chicago stand-ups that are got their own careers moving in direction. You kind of mentioned at one point, I read in something about the idea that they kind of in and out of, even in Crashing, they're in and out of the storyline
because
they have films and shows. Is it hard to sort of maintain a real connection with your friends when you're all growing together?
It can be, but there's also a nice side of it where you're all a group of weirdos who don't mind bailing on each other. Like Kumail lives a couple blocks from me, another Chicago native. We started at the Cubby Bear actually on the same Tuesday. Like we both went to that open mic on the same first time we were both doing it. And here we are, he's on HBO and now I have the show on HBO. And we still do stand up obviously together sometimes. It's so fun to see him. But you know, I sometimes joke that I book these people on the show, like TJ, because I haven't seen them.
Yeah, right.
It's like the Larry Sanders thing. It's like, oh, man, it'd be great to see TJ. But then, you know, they can be special friends. A lot of people have close friends where you don't see them for 6 months, but then you pick right back up. Right. That's how I really feel like that's how it is in the community. And that's something I really want to show on Crashing is one of the first things people think when we talk about stand-up is backstabbing or social climbing or ambition and steal ideas or do whatever it takes. And there were pockets in the comedy scene that were like that. But there are also these pockets of your John Mulaney's and your Nick Kroll's and your T.J. Miller's and these guys that are in the service of the community and the craft and aren't in it to get girls or money or fame. They were in it because they love comedy. And that's what rings so true when you see someone, even like Judd Apatow. I joke all the time, Judd should be in St. Bart's. You know what I mean? Like, why is he doing this? To get his name out there?
Right.
He's doing it because he is a stand-up. He loves comedy, and he loves doing comedy. And that's the same of everybody. Why did Sarah Silverman do it? That was a real-life example of someone doing a favor for me. And we're not that close. I mean, I love her, and we're friends, but we don't, like, have birthday dinners or anything. So,
but it's about the art of it. I mean, in a way, it's
like
the idea they support, but also the idea that you can be creative together in these projects that are real.
Well, at a certain point, it's like, why are you doing what you're doing? And it is that high school idea, the high school guidance counselor. Like, let's just give you $100 million. What are you going to keep doing? And the answer for me is I'd stand up, and I would continue to do my podcast, and I'd continue to try and tell stories and make shows that remind people that, I don't mean to get too NPR on you.
That's okay.
The idea that if it's hard or if it's difficult and if it stinks, then you're doing it right. I don't hear enough people talking about that.
Right.
That all of these journeys that people go on start with things, divorce or bombing or whatever it is, that we didn't want to happen to us. So I think that's one of the reasons why we love those stories. So I don't look at our show as a show about stand-up as much as I see it as a show about that growth.
It's about passion.
And that passion and that calling and friends and romance and love and all the things that we care about. But when you make it about comedians, like I said, you have a great excuse to be really funny while you're doing it.
It's one of the best shows in 2017 for sure. Crashing,
really,
which just got season two, which is great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Crashing, which is on HBO Sunday night, so you can check it out at HBO, HBO Go. Pete Holmes in town for the 53rd Chicago International Television Festival, which is taking place at the AMC River East 21 in Streeterville tonight and tomorrow.
53rd. I'm still writing 52nd on all my checks.
Pete Holmes, a former Chicago stand-up who has had a show on TBS, stand-up specials on Comedy Central.
Yep.
HBO does the podcast You Made It Weird for Nerdist. Pete, thanks so much for being my guest. Appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thank you.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Picture me out of the side.
You just pop out.
Right.
And Greg Flam.
Yep.
It's Swap Meet Wednesday night here, 312-981-7200. Love this segment. This is where we take time out of your busy schedule to really evaluate, to brag about your collectors, your collectibles.
Psychoanalyze
why you kept that junk.
Right.
Evaluate your memorabilia, whatever you like. If you want to know what it's worth or if you just want to brag about how cool it is.
Yep.
312-981-7200. Greg Flam, he's at DuPage Picker on both Facebook and Twitter. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin.
All right, what do you got tonight? What'd you bring in?
Kept it low here. I've got the Radio Shack Super Armatron. It was like a robot arm.
You kept it low. This is low.
And just some novelty cans.
First of all, what is this? The Super Armatron. It's the robot arm.
Yeah, it was Radio Shack Tandy Corp. And they made two versions. This is the super one. Then there was just the Armatron.
What's the year on that thing?
Oh, I'd have to say it's 79, 80.
You can tell by the way that the kids are portrayed. They have
they're like professors.
They're like professor nerds.
Right.
Look at us nerds playing with the robots.
Yep, but early AI going in there.
Yeah.
And then I have my junk thing is novelty cans. I like the snow in a can or, Florida sun in a can. I collect that type of stuff for some reason. And, I got hooked because a few years ago I sold one from the 50s for $56.
Jeez.
And you do that and you're like, now I'm looking behind books and stuff for this stuff. And anyway.
So these are novelty cans.
Yeah, so I got, this week is the anniversary of the JR, the Dallas final episode. Right. So I had that one. And then I've got
that's a beer?
This is actually a beer and it's still full. So if you want to crack that open later.
JR beer.
Right. And then I've got Indianapolis 500. This has been drained.
They're like, we're going to have t-shirts.
Yep.
We're going to have board games.
Yep.
We're going to have beer.
Everything. Right.
What do you think a six pack of JR beer goes for in 1982 or whenever that happened?
Yeah, probably $2 probably.
Would you like the Bush Light or the JR beer?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, then I have my snow in a can and my super can, which is like Superman, they would sell it at Peacock Alley in Fort City. You could put your gift in there and they would seal it in the mall for you. And then you put your tag on it. It's kind of novelty stuff.
That's cool.
I like that.
All right. 312-981-7200. Good start. Let's bring in the listeners. Let's bring in Diane's. Diane, let's start with you, Diane. What do you want to brag about, Diane?
Hi there.
Oh, I have a Kiss pinball machine.
Awesome.
Very nice.
It was it's a Bally machine,
right.
And the documents say 1978,
right.
And we probably bought it 1980-81, and we're looking to sell it.
Where do you put it? It's in the basement? Was it a centerpiece for the room?
The basement is the playroom in the house, so we have the pinball machine, a pool table, a ping pong table.
No indoor jacuzzi?
No, that's on the second level.
Oh, there you go. Gotcha.
Diane, can I ask a personal question about that jacuzzi? How often is it broken?
We've had it for 26 or 27 years, and it's yet to break.
Now, nice. That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Right.
Usually people have jacuzzis, or it's like, well, I got to keep the tarp on. There's something wrong with the jet. Moving along in this tour.
Right. Three times a year, the cleaner.
Well, you're very lucky. All right. So a 1978 Bally Kiss pinball machine.
So big question.
Greg.
It still works?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great news. I've seen two recently online that have sold for, they don't give the exact price because it says about $2,500 best offer. And there are about four currently available ranging from $25,000 to $6,000. So It's in.
What do you mean they don't tell you what it's sold? Like it's getting a certain level?
Yeah, well, that's, if I went to a different app, maybe I would get the exact price. But eBay just gives you like, it says $2,500, best offer accepted. So they don't give you like, the exact amount. Yeah, it's just.
But around that ballpark, it has
but
to
yeah,
be.
But yeah, it'd have to probably be in the 2000 range, I would guess, especially working.
So the lower range rather than the upper range.
Yeah, the low range would probably be 2000. Hopefully you can find someone that might be willing to pay more. But there are four right now online, so you've got some competition with it, but it is a nice item.
And, Diane, it's very important when you sell this thing that they have to move it.
Right.
You can't be responsible for moving that thing out of the basement. That's their job.
Oh, no.
Get your money before
the goals in selling it is to get somebody else to take it away.
Right.
I've been one of those guys who's like, could you come over and help me move this pinball machine? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Alrighty, well, I'll look online. So, and the best way to get rid of it would be putting it like on eBay.
You could just do pickup only, local pickup only on eBay, or you can put it on Craigslist. But you're going to get more money probably on eBay than Craigslist.
Love it. Thanks, Diane.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Good luck.
All right, cool. Good start. Pinball machine.
That was strong.
I could bring out all my memories of moving pinball machines.
Yeah.
And indoor jacuzzis.
There you go.
312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We got some texts. We get some calls in. Greg Flamm, we're doing Swap Meet here Wednesday night on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, we're back at it. Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Give us a call. Text in what you want to brag about tonight. If you want to know what the value is of some of your collector's items, your memorabilia, your artifacts, your junk.
Right.
Greg Flamm is here. He's at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. And he is with us every Wednesday night here on The Download. Let's go to the texts. 312, I have a 1935E silver certificate, $1 bill in very good condition. I have no idea what that means, Greg. What does that mean?
Okay. My dangerous knowledge with that, the big difference is you need to know if it was circulated or uncirculated. That kind of determines.
But what is that? What do you mean a silver certificate, $1 bill?
It's like printed on there. I guess it's supposed to be the equivalent of the silver amount, I guess, back in the day. And it says silver certificate on the actual bill, right above where it says like $1.
It's a $1 bill.
Right, but they put silver certificate on there. And again, the condition, if it was circulated or not, it's a big swing. It goes from like $2.50 upwards of $400. So
for one,
yeah. So you gotta have it's one of the things like baseball cards. You gotta have it graded. You gotta make sure.
$1 bill could get you $400.
Right.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. So you need to know we need to know whether or not it was
uncirculated or circulated.
Yeah. That'll make a big difference in evaluating.
But they kind of said it was in very good condition, which is leading me to believe it's a used dollar bill, silver certificate dollar bill.
Yeah, because if it wasn't circulated, it'd be awesome condition.
Yeah, and they would probably have it in plastic, And that's what you want to do if you do have one.
Learning about the dollar bill. Like I said, tonight.
Dangerous knowledge here.
312-981-7200. 630 says, I have a box full of various European money from between 1935 to 1945, but it was also fairly circulated, before it was stored.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance to look. Knowing the country would be a little bit better if they could text in the specific
country's various European money.
Yeah.
But a lot of that money doesn't get used anymore because of the euro. So, you're right. Depends on the country.
Yeah,
do you find people there's a market for used European currency?
Any currency pretty much.
Really?
Vintage currency, anything. It's usually one of those things behind glass at the estate sales. It's marked too high. I just walk by and try to find something else buried in the basement. So.
And this is really for Pete. This is a 630 who texted in saying, Train Spotting is available on Amazon for $2.99. So. Pete was looking for it earlier.
Oh, nice.
We were talking to Danny Boyle. So just said,
keeping
the spirit.
I thought it was the soundtrack. I wore that soundtrack out.
Right?
Born Slippy.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Mike. Mike.
Yeah.
What do you want to brag about, buddy?
I have a case of 24 Pepsis, the 12-ounce, in the wooden case that they came in.
A nice
wooden case.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering if that's worth anything, and I have My buddy has a Budweiser. Remember the horse that ran around in,
oh, yeah,
in that thing? He has brand new, and it's still in the box.
And it was like a glass globe or a plexiglass globe, and it wrote on. Yeah, that's like the holy grail of like bar.
Oh, really?
Brewery. Yeah. That's like upwards of 1,200, I could tell you right now. Maybe more, depending on condition. The
You should tell your buddy that it's not worth anything.
Right.
I'll take that off your hands.
$50 for so the Pepsi wooden case, is it kind of like a foot high, or is it the thinner one that's like 4 inches, 3 or 4 inches?
No, it's like 3/4 inch wood box,
right,
with the handles.
Right.
And it has a little bit of metal on the side.
Okay.
So it holds it together.
Yeah, and you have the bottles as well?
Yeah, and they're full. So they ain't,
wow,
even old.
Yeah, I mean, empty bottles with the wooden case are going for about $135.
Really?
Yeah.
$135?
Yeah.
If they're full.
And if they're full, I would think they'd be worth more if they were full. I'm trying to find. I can't even find full.
The fructose right, is more.
Yeah, get it before they tax you on
before
that.
They tax you on the fructose. Mike, that's good. That's a good find.
Yeah, I would start an auction at $135 if you do sell it.
There you go.
Well, build on the computer.
Yeah.
If you want to write me at DuPage Picker through Facebook or whatever, I can help you with that.
Yeah, help you out. Look up DuPage Picker. Thanks, Mike. All right, let's go to Joshua. Joshua, what do you want to brag about, buddy?
Actually, it was passed on to me through my father. When his aunt was younger, her mom worked for the Brooklyn Dodgers and had everyone on the 1947 team sign a letterhead giving her a get well soon. So basically, people like the likes of Jackie Robinson and everyone on that 1947 team are on this letterhead.
The other guys. Jackie Robinson and the other guys.
Yeah. The other guys. Yeah, exactly.
What does something like that go for when they're doing? Because, you know, Greg, I've learned from doing the swap meet that, you know, you almost want it to just be the signatures, an actual get well message, which is great and awesome for posterity in history and your family, Joshua. Doesn't do well because it's too specific.
Yeah, it's personal, and we've also talked about how one signature can tend to be worth more than like many signatures, you know, like on a ball. So you got that, and it's also because it's kind of a get well note and it could be personal, it really might not only, it might only be worth $50 maybe for the actual signature, but that's something you probably just want to keep and hold on to since it was personal.
Oh yeah, no, it's been in put in a vacuum sealed letterhead.
That's good.
In my dad's sports room.
That's cool. Great. Yeah, cool. There you go.
All right, thanks, Joshua.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate
it. Thanks, guys. You have a great day.
You too. All right, let's go to Joe. I don't even know what this is. Joe, what do you want to brag about,
you?
Joe? What do you got?
I love this program.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, man.
Hey, when I was talking to your producer, I forgot the third item I wanted to clue you guys about. I'll start with a funny one. What's a 6-pack of Billy beer on open worth?
That's right up my alley. Let's see.
6-pack of Billy beer?
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah,
like
Jimmy's brother, I guess.
Right. Yep. No, I've seen those quite often. Never a full 6-pack, though. Usually just one or two cans.
You got something there.
So, yeah, we'll see what's going for. I'm going to guess $15, $30, but I'm looking it up here.
Okay.
And what was your second item?
Okay, the second item is a bunch of Scrimshaw I picked up over, you know, quite some years ago, about 30, 40 years ago, around the Boston area. You know, the whale's tooth with, you know, carvings on it.
Okay.
I don't think there are any.
What is
really
it? Scrimshaw?
Yeah.
Scrimshaw, yeah.
Okay.
The whale's tooth that sailors, you know, instead of carving pieces of wood, they used whale's tooth and they carved pictures of boats on them, captains, you know, seascapes, if you will.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Very nor'eastern. I like that.
Yeah, I'll have to.
Scrimshaw. I'm learning. You know, it's not only. Do I get to know the listeners and what you have in your memorabilia? But I'm also learning. I'm bettering myself.
Sure.
I did not know what Scrimshaw was. We learn every day. I appreciate it. Scrimshaw. Okay, and you say you had a third item on that, too?
Yeah. It's a geode. About 8 inches in diameter, 8 to 10 inches in diameter, a fairly large one, full of amethyst. A semi-precious stone.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Got that one. I know amethyst. I'm an avid Zelda player. You know, well, Joe, come on.
Quickly back to the Scrimshaw. They're $15 and up, depending how large and obviously the art.
And the elite style of the whale. You know, you want it, the better the whale, the better the Scrimshaw.
I mean, if you had like, you know,
humpback or you right, know, gray whale. Right. Yeah, sure.
The gray humpback. Come on, Joe. What kind of show do you think this is? The gray whale is what we're looking for. Scrimshaw from the gray.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. What's the range, guys? 15 to 100?
Yeah, I mean, sky's the limit. Depends on what's on it. So.
Gotcha. Oh, sky's the limit. Okay. Gotcha.
If you want to send a picture, you know, Facebook or here, we'll check it out.
Gotcha.
There you go.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's, and we got that. And then the third one.
I'm kind of lost on right now. On that.
The geode?
The geode, the amethysts.
Oh.
Yeah. It's chock full of amethyst.
Okay.
Oh. It's kind of pretty. I bought my wife in the past, you know, amethyst jewelry, whatever.
Right.
But, you know, I collected this one, I think, in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
Shoot, I don't know, 40 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing some as high as about 500. Plus,
oh really?
Starting, I couldn't tell you. There aren't that many on there, so that's a good thing that there aren't that many.
All right, Joe.
That baby.
Yep.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
good luck.
Thanks for calling in. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the update on tonight's news with Rob. Some traffic, Esmeralda. Greg Flam in studio. We're doing Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Yep.
312-981-7200. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. This is the segment we do every Wednesday night where we give you a chance to brag about your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk.
Yep.
Whatever you like. You also find out if it's worth anything. Greg will let you know. We got a full full phone line, so let's get right to it. Why don't we start with Jim? Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Last summer I was at my company picnic and in a raffle, and I won...
Yeah.
A pair of signed Air Jordans, the Ferrari number 14s.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how long I should hang on to them or wait until
the shoe is called a Ferrari.
Yes. Oh. And every year Jordan comes out with a version of them. He signs only 23 of them, and this one is the ninth one signed with his signature on it, and it has a certification.
Okay. I can't find the number 14 pair, but a pair of signed Jordans are about $4,000.
Right. What?
And it's
you
funny
be
because
me.
Just one shoe is like $300. So you go from one to the pair, jumps that high, you know, for the pair.
Yeah, these are unworn and still in a velvet bag in the original box.
Very nice. Yeah, I have to do some more research to find like the number 14.
What? Yeah, right.
But if they're signed and they're Jordans, you know, you've got
how much do like the old red and black ones like the Mars, remember, like,
right.
Is it the shoes? Like, how much are those going for?
I've heard,
not worn and they're signed by Michael Jordan?
I've heard thousands. Not even signed. Just if you have those shoes, like, in mint condition still in the box, there's, like, thousands.
What if you're like me and you don't have them in mint condition?
And you wore them? I mean, I've sold some Air Jordans that weren't signed and they were worn.
All right, let's get rid of the Jordans. Let's go down to Andre Agassi.
Oh, okay.
Are there any Agassis
Swiss.
On
the... What about Swiss shoes?
Okay, you know, I remember in high school having, like, I was really into, like, the turquoise or the teal and the orange shoe.
Right.
The Nike Agassi.
Gotta look that up.
Yeah, those aren't going for nothing. All right, Jim. That sounds cool, man.
It's
I like
good.
It.
That's a good
All
one.
Right. All Thanks right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Mike, give us some history here. What do you got, Mike? What do you want to brag about?
You talking to me?
Yeah. You're Mike, right?
Hi, Mike.
Okay, I'm stuck. Yeah. got an 1848 Springfield rifle used in the Civil War with the bayonet.
Okay.
It's got a notch in the butt where the other bayonet fits in perfectly, so I don't know if it was used to defend, but
yeah,
it's like in mint condition.
Wow. I mean, they're upwards of, you know, I found them for $200 to $1,300. I didn't have your information for the actual model. I'm trying to find that right now, but I'd say you're probably in the higher end there of $1,300 or more.
Wow. I have a question.
Pretty interesting. I would take it into the school when the kids were having Civil War days in fifth grade.
Okay.
And let each kid try to cock this thing back. You got to double cock it and try and hold it because there's some book about a 10-year-old kid who joined the war.
Okay.
And probably one out of every 30 kids could actually pull that.
Wow. And you know what? I totally forgot you had the actual gun. Just the bayonet part is upwards of 1,300.
Yeah,
so just the bayonet's 1,300.
Yeah, so if you got the gun with the bayonet, you're probably many thousands.
You know, the first thing you do is stop letting those grimy little kids, 10-year-olds, touch it.
Yep.
Well, you gotta clean that up. The only thing you do, you cannot even try to attempt to shoot this thing. Because, you know, so I would try, but...
Yeah, right. What would happen? It's just kind of explode, right?
Yeah, and it was probably a hard rifle to shoot, is probably what he's saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he didn't want me to try, so...
Awesome.
What other guns are for. Yeah, it's cool. It's a really cool piece.
Cool.
Yeah, if you send a picture, I'll get a proper grading or whatever on that for you.
Yeah, I'll do that. You're...
At DuPage, Picker on Facebook or Twitter.
Or Twitter.
Okay.
Thanks, Mike.
Oh, I'll do that. No problem. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, you really... I'm glad that Mike can bring his 1848 rifle into the school to see if the 10-year-olds can cock it. I think that in this day and age, that'll get you a lockdown.
Nice.
You can't be walking in with that kind of stuff.
Very cool.
All right. Let's keep going. Let's go to Buddy. Buddy, what do you want to brag about, Buddy?
Hey, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man.
I got a shark tooth that was carbon dated at about 6.5 million years ago.
Wow.
What?
And I'm trying to figure out where...
What does that even mean? What do you mean he carbon dated for 6 million years ago?
It's like they do with old bones, like dinosaurs and stuff.
So this shark is 6 million years old?
Yeah, it was a great white shark.
That's
wild. The tooth is like, it's like about 5 inches tall.
Wow.
And it's solid.
I've lost track of how long we've been on this planet, but I don't even feel like it's been 6 million years.
Well, it was carbon dated by the United States Navy, so with my government.
That's wild because,
obviously. Trump's right. Fake news.
You look online and, it's hard, to give you an exact price because they're anywhere from $3. Obviously, you've got way more than $3, but I'm just saying, I'd have to do a lot more research.
I feel like it would be like the centerpiece, what you're talking about, to say that the Navy said it's a $6 million or 6 million year old tooth. It'd be like the centerpiece of SeaWorld. Like you walk in, it'd be like there'd be an hour and a half line to see that thing, right?
Yep.
I thought about maybe taking it over to the Shedd Aquarium. Maybe they might purchase
you need
it.
To get that looked at.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, it was carbon dated, so
I guess I
trust the Navy because it was given to me by a good friend. So
More
intense.
Info on that.
I like that a lot, though. That's my favorite of the night, buddy. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen. You have a great evening.
You too.
Thank you.
A 6 million year old carbon dated shark tooth. If I were Buddy, I'd put that on a necklace.
Right.
I'd wear that around. What a party starter. What a conversation starter.
I mean, not to bring the guy down, but I found a 30 million year old fossilized
shark. You guys are just making stuff up.
But wait, 50 cents starting auction.
What? That's
it's like they're all over the place.
This is a racket. Half the stuff I'm like, oh, that's not worth anything.
Right.
Like this can of Three's Company air, it's just air, is worth $500. But a 30 million year old shark tooth is 50 cents.
Right. I mean, and I know that's not his, but how all over the board.
Love it. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll wrap up Swap Meet this week. Hopefully something better than a 6 million year old tooth. All right, Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. I got a lot of great texts coming in. So far, my favorite. 630 says they sell the old shark teeth at every other shop in Florida. All right, sorry. No, I don't have my Florida gift shop game down tight. Thought maybe it was shells, but also teeth. Also, 630 sent, this is probably my favorite of the night, Scrimshaw Erotica.
Not touching.
It's like it's whale's tooth. Scrimshaw's a whale's tooth. Is it tooth as well?
I guess.
And then they do sexual stuff, like art.
Art, right? Erotica.
Erotica. Thank you, Greg. Love it. 847. I've got a Stretch Armstrong and the Red Villain guy too.
Okay, now we're talking.
Yeah.
Those have gone. He's got the villain with it. It's about $500 to $800 for both of them.
What?
Yeah. That's a good one.
Okay. Is 605 says I have a NASA hat signed by the crew of Apollo 11.
Yeah, I couldn't find that. I couldn't find any signed NASA hat, but it is cool.
Astronauts don't usually sign stuff, do they?
Yeah, I guess.
I guess they do. 815 says they have a six-pack of 11-ounce Coors bottles from 1973.
Yeah, that I still have to look up.
Yeah. There you go. Beer. I love that there's so much beer that has not been drank, or Pepsi that has not been drank. I guess that goes for something. Let's keep going, and let's go to Randy. Randy, what do you like? What do you want to brag about, Randy?
Yeah, I got a Hot Light cookie jar.
Okay.
When they first came out, like in 1932.
Ooh,
it's in the head. It's still got the like the price tag on the top of the head, but you can't see what the price was behind there.
Okay, just to verify, it's just kind of a upper torso one, right? I just want to make sure I have the right.
Yeah,
okay.
The head, yeah.
Yeah, they're going for 117 to about 285 is what they've been selling for. There's quite a few on there, so condition's going to be a big deal. But, yeah, but you do have, that's a pretty good find. How long have you had it, or how did you get it?
It was from my grandparents.
Okay.
Yeah, they had it from day one, and I always wanted it, and they left it for me.
Nice.
And it's even got the pipe, too.
Okay, good, yeah.
Corncob pipe.
Yep.
I said it's mint.
No, that's good. Definitely get that thing in a nice, cool, strong box unless you're going to get rid
there
of it.
There you go. All right. Thanks,
like
Randy.
$200 did you set it for?
117 to 285.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Hey, I got a Bozo Sings 33 LP. On one side is Filbert the Frog. On the other side is Bozo's song. It's got the cover folder. It says copyright 1948.
Okay.
It's got some wear and tear on it, but it's in really good shape. Bright picture of Bozo on the cover.
Okay, with a white background, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, looks like they're going for $15 and up, sad to say. I'm trying to find anything higher.
What?
But
come on, okay. $15 and up?
Yeah, let me see what else I can find on that.
Oh man,
the good news are there isn't that many of them, so you right now you could probably ask much more than that, probably in the $40
range. A 1948 single released by Bozo.
Yep,
going for $15.
Yeah,
that's not good.
Yeah, I would do an auction. This person did buy it now, so they might have shorted themselves, you know, on that by doing a buy it now price.
All right, Jim. Well, I like it, Jim.
All right, thanks.
I don't know if the free market loves it, but I love it.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks. All right.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye. All right. 312-981-7200. 847 says, I have a pull string Pee Wee Herman doll. Does it go?
I saw one this past weekend. I could have got it. It was $45, though, at an estate sale. Yeah. So if it's in the box, it's obviously much more than that. But just loose, they were asking $45 for it.
All right, back on the Coors six pack.
Yeah,
who cares? I don't mean that in any disrespectful way, but I'm like, it's not not really going for much.
Yeah, I've had it, and it is right here. One bottle is about $10. So
oh, no, I was wrong.
That's not bad. If he's got the case, you know, with it and all good condition, I'm trying to find a full six pack of it.
You know what I'm getting? I'm getting lectured on the text about sharks.
Yeah, you're going to get it.
Yeah, because I was, I couldn't believe that it was that old. 630 says, sharks have been here since day one.
Right.
They were one of the largest to have ever lived. So there you go.
Yep.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Ken. Ken, what do you want to brag about, Ken?
Yes, they have a beer can, never been open, old style. It's from the 85 Bears Super Bowl.
Oh, nice.
So they made an old-style beer that says, like, congrats? Or...
Yeah, it says old-style in the front, and it says Chicago Bears Super Bowl champions.
Oh, okay. Nice. Yeah, I would have drank that so fast.
I wouldn't drink it now, though.
Oh, no.
I don't think so. Let's see if I can get it here.
Well, just based on the Coors, I mean, they wanted, what, for $10 a bottle? I would assume a can of old-style with the 85 championship Bears on the back would be the same.
Well, the good news, did they have, like, players on it? Like, I see one with Peyton on it. for $8. I see.
No, it didn't have no players. It has a bear on it.
Yeah, not finding them, so that might be a good thing.
And all right,
start an auction and ask what you want for it.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. I like that though. I just hold on to its party starter.
Yep.
All right, let's keep going. 630 wants to know, how about a Jay Cutler signed football? Think it's worth anything?
Yeah, good luck with that. I've got some Cutler stuff, and I'm just going to hold on to it and hopefully
see what happens.
Because you're not going to get much now. Yeah.
Let's go to Albert. Albert, what do you want to brag about, Albert?
Hey, gentlemen, I have a Muhammad Ali pinball machine, just a glass. Pictures of him on there, and it's in great shape. And the TV guide, I think that's from 72.
Okay.
It's a drawing of him with his hands up in the air, in black and white.
Okay. Cool.
All right, Albert.
Sorry. We'll get you the price.
We'll get to that. And let's get, right before we get in here, right at the end here, let's get Steve as well. Steve, last call, buddy. What do you want to brag about?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How about
you? Good. I got a 1958 Omega Seamaster in 18 karat gold in mint shape.
A watch?
Yeah, and I can't find nobody that can give you a price on it.
Wow. Well, all right. I'm finding it here, and I'm going to get you a price in a second.
We need like computer music from the 80s. It's like
$500 to $4,100 depending on.
That's a stretch.
It is.
$500 to $4,100
And that's sold, yeah. I mean, the average price is about $1,000 to $1,200 the few that I'm seeing.
All right,
here.
Cool.
All right.
Very cool.
All right. Good. Thanks, Steve. That's probably there's a lot of good stuff tonight. And the Muhammad Ali.
The full pinball machine is going for about $2,000. So if he's just got the glass, I'm thinking $150 maybe for the glass, and start an auction and see if it can go higher.
And finally tonight, 630, a Bears football signed by Butkus, Urlacher, and Wilson. What a weird. How do you do that? Do you just have the ball, and then each time a new player comes along, or do you think they were like at a charity thing together?
Yeah, maybe just ran into them at different charities, maybe.
Like you got the Butkus, and you're like, you know what? This
he's carrying around.
Or
that
did
ball.
He go? Did he go? You know what? Otis Wilson is the. You know, forget the Singletary guy. Let's go, because it would make more sense to be Butkus, Singletary, Urlacher, right?
Right.
But maybe he hedged the bets on Otis. He's like, you know what? Otis is the better. He's going to be the better player. I'm going to go with Otis. I can't get Mike the line's too long for Iron Mike.
Yeah, I'd have to just advise people for future reference, get a different ball signed for each person.
Well, maybe, yeah.
You know, as far as investment.
Greg, always a pleasure, buddy.
It is. Always fun.
Next week, I think we're off next week, right, with Blackhawks are playing?
Hawks game, yep.
Yeah, so we'll be back on April 5th. Mm-hmm. Greg Flamm, at DuPage Picker on both Facebook and Twitter. And we got something else?
Orland Park this weekend at the Civic Center. Like 60-plus vendors, so go nuts.
The Orland Park Civic Center this weekend. Yep. Greg Flamm there. Swap meet. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Patty Vasquez up next here on 720 WGN. Hello, how are you?
Every time I listen, I want to to this segment. I want to go through my basement night,
right?
And I always and you always think like money, like old money from the 1930s, but it was in circulation, not so much.
I learned things I didn't know.
Right?
I've been lectured for the last 20 minutes on shark teeth. I guess that's a thing, you know, because he said, Buddy said he had a shark tooth from 6 million years old. That's what I said. I'm like, what do you mean? I didn't even know this planet was around that long. And then they're like, that's a Florida thing. Then somebody called and said, no, they got that stuff in Florida gift shops. Like, you can get that kind of stuff. He looked it up. Greg looked it up and he said it was 50 cents.
Oh,
this whole thing.
That's like arrowheads. Like arrowheads aren't worth as much as you would think.
Yeah,
they would
right.
Be. I was fascinated by the fact that Joe called, regular caller of our show. We call him Pumpkin because he calls me kiddo. We haven't heard from him for a while, but apparently on your show, he's calling you. So
he's got a lot of amethysts to give away.
He has a huge amethyst. No one's got amethyst like Joe does. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, by the way, for stepping up and doing the Mermaids event on
Yeah,
Sunday.
I'm looking forward to it.
I won't be there.
You won't be there?
Not because of the two-piece necessity for that, but you're Merman.
It's super funny.
Are you going to go Mermaid or Merman?
I guess I'm going Merman. I haven't done much. Stephanie asked me to do it, and then I was like, and I saw the instructions today, and it said, you can bring a one-piece or a two-piece, and I'm like,
You want a scuba suit kind
of,
don't
you? Like, I'm not sure. No, I'm okay. I will see something embarrassing that my wife said to me. She goes, are you doing the mermaid thing on Sunday? And I'm like, I think so, yeah. And she's like, are you going to, you know, do any manscaping? And I was like, what does that mean? And she's like, you know, like maybe your armpit hair.
Oh.
And I'm like, what's wrong with my armpit hair? And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do a thing.
You just
like,
found out that there's something wrong
yeah.
with your armpit
she's
hair,
like,
by the way.
She's like, you need to trim that up. And I'm like, that's, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Wow. Rob, do you trim the armpit hair?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I've never thought about this.
I never thought about it either, but I obviously am not doing it right.
I don't know if my husband does.
You know, things get a little, you know, gnarly down that way.
Yeah. I guess.
So, do you also scape down the middle, down the chest plate?
No. I mean, no. You know.
I don't know.
Just, you know.
Okay.
Mrs. Rob digs it, so I don't touch that.
Hey, look,
area.
This is coming from someone who had their nose hairs waxed on the air before, so I'm not judging anybody.
Oh, see, that, you know, that's pain. But that's pain
that?
For it.
Yeah, I've been waxed other places. It's not that bad.
Well, I'll have to take your word for it.
When you have to hold yourself in different positions so they can get at it, that's when you...
I'm talking about a couple of snips of the little scissors.
Yeah, you'll be
on
fine.
The air
well, tell her if she doesn't like it, she can help you with the scissors.
Yeah, right.
That's all I'm saying. Get up in there. Well, have a great night, Justin.
All right, you too. Take care, Patty.
We have Wayne Baker Brooks coming in, by the way. And we have Ivana from Jake and Melnick's in studio with us. We are right now going to the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.